And most appointed officials in the city, and it is something that is meant to educate you about ethics laws, not make you an expert, but essentially allow you to have that gut feeling or red flags come up if there's an ethics issue, so you know not to do it, if there's ethically compromised behavior, or to know to consult the city attorney, city manager, city clerk on an issue. I also wanted to introduce myself, Chris Neumeier, Morro Bay City Attorney. A lot of you know Joe from before, and Joe's retired, and the council has picked me to replace him. And I also want to introduce Brian Wright Bushman, your new assistant city attorney, who also has a lot of roots in the local community, went to college up here, and his sister lives up here. So he's definitely, he wants to be a native, so see how it goes for him. So what we're going to do today is talk about four basic areas of ethics and public service. And as I'd mentioned before, too, this is something that's required for all office holders and appointed elected officials. Just want to note that the mayor and Councilman Heller, Councilwoman Addis, and the city manager, they've already done their AB 1234 training at a conference they attended earlier, if you notice that they're not here today.
Chris, would you like this? Do you want
me to do it? You can do it. Yep. Okay, so the first slide, session objectives. What we're going to talk about today is we're going to familiarize you with laws that govern your service and when to ask questions, encourage you to think beyond legal restrictions and provide tools for doing so, and we're also going to help you comply with the AB 1234 requirements. And if you have questions during this, please raise your hand. I know it can actually be not probably the most exciting 2 hours you're going to spend in 2019, so feel free to raise your hand. And on that note, does anyone know why we do AB 1234 and what it means? Anyone? Feel like Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Anyone? Ferris? Yeah, you have to. And it's Assembly Bill 1234, for what it's worth. And that gets kind of lost in the name. And there were a lot of questionable acts that occurred by some districts back in the 80s. And so California passed Assembly Bill 1234, and it requires the 2 hours of training within a year of assuming office, and then every 2 years thereafter. So for sessions logistics, it's a two-hour session, and we're actually going to have proof of participation certificates for you to sign, and please turn those into the city clerk. And those are subject to Public Records Act requests. So if somebody wants to check whether you've done your training, they can ask the city clerk, you know, is it on file? And if it's not, then they'll know the training hasn't occurred. So ethics laws versus ethics. I wanted to point out that law is often a starting point for ethical analysis. And the law is what we must do. And what I want to emphasize today is that just because it's legal doesn't necessarily mean it's ethical. And I also want to emphasize, too, I'm not here to teach you ethics, to teach you morality. You know, I will assume that everyone already has their own moral compass and everyone already has their own ethical values. What we're here today to talk about is legal issues that might get you in trouble and also ethical standards that are higher than the minimum requirements of state ethics laws. And also, like I said, to make sure that throughout your career as a public servant, you don't get tripped up inadvertently with some sort of ethical violation, because that's more often than not the issue. Most people aren't corrupt. Most people aren't going to violate these rules intentionally. But we want you to know what they are so you don't get tripped up with them. So on the next slide, AB 1234 ethical values. These are the four core principles that the California Attorney General has laid out. Trustworthiness, respect, responsibility, and fairness. And these are the basic four ideas that are supposed to generate good ethical behavior in local government. And so next slide, a little exercise here. Take a minute to rate yourself. Are you always, mostly, somewhat, seldom, or never ethical? You don't have to answer. Okay, now next slide. How would others rate you? Now, if there's some inconsistency between those, it's to illustrate the point that as public servants, it's often perception that matters. And so you want to make sure that the public maintains their trust in the government by being not only at the minimum standards of ethical behavior, but going above that. Because the whole point of local government is for the community to be able to work together. And so if others, for whatever reasons, think that you're not following the ethical standards that you believe you hold yourself to, then there probably is an issue of transparency, perhaps not following, you know, the higher standards and the minimums. And so it's a useful exercise to think about. So rationalizations for unethical conduct. Many people can go through this. It was necessary. It was legal. Won't hurt anyone. There's lots of reasons why people justify unethical behavior. Now, on the next slide, again, as I'd mentioned, public service ethics is different. It's not just your relationships with one or two people or your business dealings. This is something that's in the public sphere. And in public service ethics, you want to remember that perception is as important sometimes as reality. Now, why is that? Because if the community is not trusting their public servants, if there's an undermining in, you know, the good faith, then it's just harder to get work done, and so it impacts the entire city. So remember, perception is as important as reality. Gut is not a reliable guide. And one thing to remember, perhaps the most important thing today, because I don't expect you to memorize all this, if in doubt, send it out. And what that means is that, just for example, before this presentation began, a gentleman in the audience was talking to me and Brian about a possible issue where no bad faith, but just asking, you know, what's the law on this? And that is being done ahead of time. We also get questions ahead of time before meetings, before decisions need to be made. That gives us the ability to review, research, analyze, if need, talk to state agencies. So if in doubt, send it out. That's something that I want to just make sure I emphasize here today. So on the next slide, the four different areas that the Attorney General has recommended that we talk about in these sessions, here are some of the examples of what we're going to go over. For trustworthiness, we're going to talk about bribery, conflicts of interest, contractual conflicts, campaign contributions. For respect, Political Reform Act disclosures, Brown Act, Public Records Act. And responsibility, gift restrictions, misuse of public funds, gifts of public funds, mass mailing restrictions, and fairness. And that's going to be protection against bias, due process, incompatible offices, competitive bidding, and anti-nepotism. So on the next slide, understanding ethics laws, basically what hopefully you'll come out of here today with is what they roughly cover. And again, you know, there's not going to be a test or anything on this. You just need to participate and be here. When you need to ask questions, and then resources for further reference. And there's a quote here from Abe Lincoln, which I like, which says that nearly all men can stand adversity, but if you want to test a man's character, give him power. And that's where you all are now. You do have power because you are either an elected or appointed official. And so this is the test of character, what you do with that power. Now, the four groups of ethics law, this is specifically the four different sections we'll go over today. And I'll be splitting them up with Assistant City Attorney Brian Wright Bushman. I'll be going over personal financial gain, which is basically bribery, conflicts, Political Reform Act, FPPC rules. Brian will go over personal advantages and perks. And then I'll go over government transparency, which is Form 700, Brown Act, Public Records Act. And then fair processes, Brian will go over, which involves basically due process, making sure everyone gets, if you will, their equivalent of their day in court. I mean, notwithstanding we're not judges, but usually. And then going over legislative versus quasi-judicial distinctions, which is very important. So group number one, personal financial gain issues. Before I go into this, are there any questions anyone has? All right. Well, that can be good or bad. It depends. All right. Personal financial gain issues. The principle is public servants should not benefit financially from their positions. I mean, this is kind of obvious. I don't think anyone has any questions about that. Examples of this, bribery and related crimes, financial interest disqualification requirements, and revolving door restrictions. Now, we're going to get into conflicts, financial interest disqualification requirements. And this can be a very arcane and convoluted area of the law. And we're going to go over some of them, but this is probably the biggest example of if in doubt, send it out, because there's lots of financial conflicts that you may or may not have, which if you have them, it doesn't mean that there's something wrong going on. It just means that you can't vote on an issue. And so ahead of time, before your commission or the council votes on an issue, you just abstain from voting on it. And that's because you might have a personal financial interest in the decision. So next slide, bribery. What is bribery? We all heard of bribery, but technically it's conferring a benefit on a public official to influence a person's vote, opinion, action, or inaction. As you can imagine, there's some pretty stiff penalties, loss of office, prison time, fines, restitution, attorney's fees, and public embarrassment. And there can be a mandatory fine as well, whether or not a bribe was received or wasn't received. And also keep in mind, the person offering the bribe can also get penalties as well. An example of when bribery actually came to the forefront in California in a big way is a case study of Shrimpgate. So back in the 90s, the federal government basically brought in a sting operation to California. And they went to Sacramento, and they actually created a fictitious company that wanted some fishing rights and wanted some benefits from Sacramento for a shrimp company. That's why it was called Shrimpgate. And just straight up bribes were taken by legislators. And the governor at the time was in on this sting. It passed, and it went to the governor's desk. He vetoed it, and then they nailed these folks. So this is an example of, you know, it does happen. And the federal government, you know, will do sting operations. This was a big one. Another example, Moreno Valley. In January 2014, a former Moreno Valley council member pled guilty to accepting over a $2 million bribe from an undercover FBI agent in exchange for a promise to rezone land. And again, this was one of the biggest cases that has occurred in California, and huge, big, significant case. I don't think anything like this is happening necessarily routinely on a daily basis, of course, in the state, but it does happen, and the FBI does do sting operations like this. On the next slide, bribery, similar crimes. It also includes extortion, receiving rewards for appointing someone to public office, and embezzlement, which is converting public funds or property to your own use. And there's a common misperception when it comes to campaign donations. It's important to know that if someone receives campaign donations running for office, that doesn't mean they can't make a decision impacting the person that donated the money. In fact, the courts have ruled, and there's a clear line of decisions going back all the way to the beginning of the common law, that folks can donate money to political campaigns. I mean, that's their right. And if you were to prevent people from doing that, they can donate their time, their resources, their money. If you prevented people from doing that, you wouldn't really be able to have the community operate with you know, folks being both active in business and politics. So that's okay. And we'll go over this a little bit later. The only rule is that if you're on a commission and then you're running for elected office, you can't get donations from someone for that elected office and then make a decision on them when you're on the commission. But once you're elected, you certainly can make those decisions. Next slide, disqualification based on financial interests. This is the big one here. I mean, we all pretty much know that bribery is against the law. We all pretty much know that you shouldn't be extorting, so on and so forth. But disqualification based on financial interest, this is where people get tripped up, because it's not necessarily intuitive that if you have a certain threshold passed, of a financial interest in a business or a family member or somebody that comes before your commission or the council, that you need to walk away from the decision. And so you have a disqualifying financial interest. The technical terms for it is if it's a reasonably foreseeable material financial effect, distinguishable from the effect on the public, meaning that your decision will affect your pocketbook more than it affects the general public. Now, more than affects the general public is key, because obviously if you were not to have that exception, it'd be impossible to do any city business. Like, for example, if you're doing zoning for like half the city. And so if you have one of these disqualifications, you need to realize that you need to, and we'll go into the details, not participate in the decision. You're going to need to make sure that you actually walk away from the podium, from the rostrum. But even if you don't have a disqualification, you might want to abstain from making a decision. So keep in mind, and this is an example of where the ethical standards the state holds you to, you might hold yourself to a higher standard. Just because there isn't a legal disqualification, you might still not want to participate in a decision. And it's okay to simply say, if you're on planning commission and a decision comes to you, and even though the law says you can make the decision, you just feel it's not appropriate because you might have really close personal ties, for example, to the applicant before you. And the law might say you can make it, but you can abstain from it as well. So I want to emphasize that that's up to you, whether you want to abstain. So what kind of interests? As I said, the law says it has to be reasonably foreseeable and there needs to be a material effect on your finances. And also, it doesn't have to be certain. So you can't say, well, I don't know for a fact that it's going to affect my economic interests, a decision that comes before me. It just has to be reasonably foreseeable. So what are some examples? I know, of course, just the black letter law doesn't really illustrate much of the examples. So first example, what kind of interest? Income. There's the $500 rule. If a business or a party comes before you, you're making a decision affecting them, and you receive $500 or more in income from them in the last 12 months, you need to disqualify yourself from the decision. So that's an easy one to remember, $500 rule. It also applies to your immediate family. What kind of interests on value of business or real property? There's the $2,000 rule. Investment in a business entity or interest in real property. So again, if a developer comes before the planning commission or there's some sort of harbor lease or there's some issue where you have an investment in it and it's $2,000 or more, that's not wrong. It's not bad. It just means you can't make the decision. The law just keeps you from being in the position of thinking, how impartial can I be? So you just disqualify yourself from it. Another issue, real property. What kind of interests? On real property, there's two basic rules. If you have real property that you're making a decision on, or you think it's going to impact the real property, if it's within 500 feet, for example, if you're doing rezoning or you're issuing, say, a conditional use permit, if it's within your real property is within 500 feet of the decision you're making, then you can assume there's a conflict. But even if it's more than 500 feet, this is a relatively new rule. If a reasonably prudent person would believe the decision will influence the market value, then again, you have to disqualify yourself. Now, I say reasonably new because for those of you that have been doing city government for quite a while, it was relatively recently that people talked about the 500-foot rule, and you were good if your property was more than 500 feet from where you're making the decision. That's no longer the case. Now, there's this murky sort of loosey-goosey rule from the FPPC that just says, well, maybe it'll affect the market value, maybe it won't. Then you have to consider that. So I want to point that one out. That's important. Next one. Yes?
I do have a question on this because one of the issues that the city council is going to be addressing is vacation rentals. VRBO is vacation rental by owner. Mm-hmm. And because they're located all over the city, virtually every council member will be within 500 feet of either a vacation rental or they might even have one, but let's just say you live within one.
Mm-hmm.
Some people would argue that the value of your house is going to increase or decrease depending on how close you are to one of those. Would that be a reason to disqualify yourself?
So in that case, I believe that the public generally exception will apply. And we're going to get to that. And that is that if 25% or more of the city is impacted in the same way and there isn't a disproportionate impact on just that council member, then you can vote on it. So when that comes up, I think we'll want to do individualized analysis on whether there's going to be a disproportionate impact. But the general rule is the vacation rentals will affect the entire city. And so, but we definitely want to look at that before the decision's made. That's a good illustration, too, of these principles because, you know, here I'm saying, well, here's one rule, and then here's another rule, and then we kind of put it together, and, you know, there's often no black letter law rules on this.
The entire council couldn't vote on it if you applied the rule.
Well, in that case, if a majority of the council is disqualified, then you actually, by random lot, pick who makes the decision. And that does happen, so... City Clerk?
I was just going to say, if you want to do the same analysis with the Planning Commission, if they're making recommendations to the Council on what those regulations should be related to vacation rentals?
It's the same thing, yes.
Yeah,
we'll absolutely want to make that analysis too. Good question. Yes?
What's the form, what does the city use to find out who's got a vacation rental?
What council?
No, but in that area of concern, somebody has a vacation rental, you don't know it, but then you get into this 500.
I believe local code requires registration.
Well,
whether or not it's occurring is another issue.
Okay, there are facts going on in a lot of areas about a, Airbnb.
Yeah, I mean, the law and the reality, I mean, it's often, I mean, marijuana dispensaries have also been an issue for decades, and they've been out there, whether or not they're legal or not, it's not a question.
We had an issue come before the council last year involving changing height limitations inside a specific zone. Two of the council members felt obliged to recuse themselves because they owned property within that zone. Is that actually a real basis for recusal, or was that just being overly conservative?
You know, I don't know the entire details of that situation, but it very well could have been an example of going above and beyond legal requirements. Because communities that are fastidious, and I believe Morro Bay is one of them, you'll see commissioners, council members, elected officials going above and beyond. So, for that case, I don't know for sure because I didn't review the exact details, but it might have been.
It just seems to really strain the whole idea of councils and planning commissions for that matter, the councils in particular, voting on generalized zoning, like general plans and zoning, because ultimately you have to be a resident of the city in order to serve. So therefore, by definition, you're going to live inside one of the zones that's. I mean, that for me is a real hard way to draw a line, and then the height issue just didn't seem relevant because both of the properties that were owned by the two councilmen were already developed, and so it wasn't like it was going to materially affect their particular interests. It might ultimately, but
yeah, that's actually a really good observation that sometimes these rules might seem to swallow the intent of local government participation. So that's a good point. So another interest, gifts. So once you actually become a council member or a commissioner and you do have power and authority in the city, there are limits on gifts you can get. Now, don't worry about holidays or birthdays. If you already have a relationship with someone and it's family or friends, you can continue to exchange gifts. What we're looking out for is suddenly you have new friends, people that weren't giving you gifts before, and now they want to shower you with gifts. That's what this is meant to stop. So if you receive a gift of over $50, you have to report it, and then there's a hard cap on $500 from that one person during the year. And so if you get little gifts, if you get, say, three gifts of $25, this is often in the form of meals or tickets or whatnot. If it goes over 50 in the aggregate, then you need to report it. And then the next slide, the public generally exception. We talked about this. This is important. If the reasonably foreseeable material effect on a financial interest does not create a conflict under the Act, it does not create a conflict, if the effect on the official's interest is indistinguishable from its effect on the public generally. So the classic example is general plan. Obviously, if you're doing the entire general plan for the city, like, it's going to impact you, or else you shouldn't be on the commission or the council because you don't live in the city. So that's a good example of public generally. It does require some analysis when it's not all cut and dried. It needs to be a significant segment of the public, at least 25%, and you can't have a unique impact. So even though it affects the entire city or more than a quarter of the city, if somehow it uniquely impacts you, then you could still be disqualified. And that's where, again, you want to have City Hall contacted so a review can be done ahead of time. So the next slide, for how long? The relevant time period is 12 months. And that's not the calendar year. That's 12 months before the decision. So you can't say, well, it's January, so anything, you know, in the last year doesn't count. No, it's 12 months back from the time the decision's made. Next slide, other ethics resources. I'd said that I want you to remember, if in doubt, send it out. I think the second thing I want you to remember that's really important is this 866 number for the FPPC. I know that the reality is that there might be a conflict where you don't feel comfortable calling the city attorney or calling the city manager and asking, but you are wondering. You can call and anonymously ask the FPPC for just their thoughts on an issue. Now, you'll have to identify yourself if you want a formal opinion, but you can get some general thoughts from them, and they'll give you the disclaimers if you don't identify yourself of, don't take this as legal advice, you know, this is just our thoughts. But you can call 1-866-ASK-FPPC. That's a great resource. They have limited hours, so don't think if you call at 4:30, you know, on a Friday, you're going to get them. But they are generally there Monday through Friday, certain hours each day. You can also email them. Institute for Local Government is a nonprofit group that provides resources. And then, of course, City Attorney's Office. Myself and Brian and the rest of the folks we work with are always available to answer questions. So we just went over a bunch of conflicts, and if it comes up that you have a conflict, what do you do? So if you are disqualified, don't discuss or influence staff or colleagues on the issue. Identify the nature of the conflict at the meeting. Leave the room, unless it's on consent. That's a relatively new rule, but you're supposed to leave the room. The presumption is that you're going to do winking or nodding or something if you're sitting up there to the other members, so you're supposed to leave the room. No voting or discussing the matter, and you don't count towards a quorum. And this relates to the question we talked about before. If you have a majority of the council or the commission disqualified, what do you do? Well, then we go to picking lots, basically, on who can make the decision. So the way this would work is, for example, you might be on planning commission and a conditional use permit comes up for a neighbor to your property that you own, and clearly it's going to impact, you know, your business or potentially could. What do you do? Well, when that item comes up at the meeting, you simply announce to the public and, you know, the rest of the commissioners, you know, I have a conflict because of ABC. I'm now going to step away from the rostrum, and you just walk and you can go to the back of the room, that's it. And then you come back up when it's done. And you're not supposed to be talking to staff or your colleagues before the decision's made to try to influence them. And it's as simple as that. And I want to emphasize that having conflicts just means you're involved in the community, that you have some interest in the community, that, you know, you're actually engaged in the community. So it's common to have disqualifying conflicts. And that's, having those is probably why you maybe are on commissions or on council, because you're involved in the community. You have businesses, you have property, you know, you're active in the community. So the issue is how you deal with it. It's not that you have a potential conflict. Next slide, leave the room rule. Again, I want to emphasize that it is the law now. You're supposed to leave the room. You don't stay up there and just look the other way. And also there are limited exceptions, and you'll see this happen sometimes. Just because you can't, as a commissioner or a council member, vote on the issue because it affects you personally, doesn't mean you lose your right to speak out on it. So you can then come back right up to public comment and say your piece. So remember that. Like, you don't have to put duct tape on your mouth and go wait out in the parking lot. You can come back and talk at public comment about the issue. It'd be before the vote. And to do that,
so you can simply walk back to the podium, address the council, and communicate with them on the same situation.
Well, I was just going to say, to be clear, that it has to be that you own the property at stake, or you own a business, or you control the business at stake. But this is where, you know, there's a balancing act between, you know, getting people to serve in local government, as the gentleman before was talking about, and then having them have their self-interest taken away. This is the balancing act. So you don't get to vote on it. You don't get to talk about it up there with the authority of I'm a commissioner or a council member. You don't get to sit up there in front of everyone on the stage. But you can just, as you know, Joe or Jane Citizen, walk around up and say, hey, you know, like that CUP example of, your business is next door to another business that wants a CUP that you believe can impact maybe your customer base or your property value or something. You don't get to vote on it because that's your authority as a commissioner. But you can walk right around up to the microphone and say, I don't like this idea. No one in my neighborhood likes this idea. Like, this is bad because we think it's going to bring, you know, people loitering at midnight or something. I don't know, whatever the business might be. But you have to actually have a direct interest, though. You can't just do it on every issue, and that's the key.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Yes?
What about the advocacy groups that come and speak on behalf of an issue one way or another, if you're a member of one of those groups that would be up there? Is the assumption, if you're a member and identified as a member of that you would be, you know, do you have an interest conflict there?
Unless there's a financial conflict, then there is not a legal issue. Depending on the nature of the situation, you know, that might be an example of where someone might voluntarily step down. But on the other hand, again, I want to emphasize there's a balancing act between, you know, your rights as a citizen and a resident of the community to speak your mind and, you know, your willingness to serve local government. And so if you're a part of advocacy groups, you know, they can come up and speak. You can be a member of it. It can be publicly known. We're going to get into the difference between legislative conflicts and quasi-judicial conflicts, though, later. And Brian's going to be talking about those. The issue there is that if you are acting as a judge, like you have an appeal or there's some sort of permit that is impacting you know, a few parties and you're applying the law, then in that case, you could have impermissible biases and you could have biased yourself out by making a decision ahead of time by being, say, part of an advocacy group. But when it comes to policy, I mean, that's the whole reason why people are participating in local government. They have positions and people know them. So that I think kind of answered your question, but maybe not completely. Okay. So we talked about leave the room rule and then penalties. So up on penalties, another quote, I like, few men have the virtue to withstand the highest bidder, from George Washington. So penalties, what can happen? If there's a conflict and you didn't recuse yourself from the decision and you voted on it, it can invalidate the decision. You can actually lose office and be disqualified in the future from holding office. It can be a misdemeanor. You can have monetary fines, attorney's fees, insofar as if somebody else brings an action to invalidate the decision, you're going to have to pay for their attorney's fees if they actually win their case. And, of course, embarrassment, personal, political. So those are the conflicts that can be resolved that we talked about by just not participating in the decision. And those are generally the easy ones in the context of the special rules for contracts. So attorneys that work with cities generally look at conflicts as being in two camps. There's the financial conflicts in general, where you just need to step down and not participate in the decision because the law doesn't want you to try to be completely impartial. And then there's contracts. And these just can't be made. It's Government Code 1090. Now, I want to emphasize that if you actually are going to do business directly with the city, then there's going to be a problem. Because if you're actually a vendor for the city, and then you're serving with the city, that contract itself is just considered to be impermissible. And we'll get into an example of that. But the big rule is that for contracts, you can't just walk away from making the decision. It's just presumed that the city is going to be contracting with you in general. There's some sort of bias because you're involved with the city. So a good example of that is Thomas versus Cal. So in this case, a council member had land that was worth about $200,000-$300,000 in the San Francisco area. And the city council wanted to buy both that land and then a bunch of surrounding land for development. Now, the council member knew that he couldn't sell that land directly to the city because he's on the council. He would be approving the contract for the land sale, presumably the price. So what happened was a developer, the one that acquired the rest of the land, told the city, well, I'll buy it from the council member, and then I'll officially be the straw man to sell it to you once I buy it from the council member. That deal happened, and it went to court. And the court said, no, that was just a straw man. Like, the escrow documents themselves talked about the council member selling it to the developer, and the developer sent it to the city. And so in that case, what happens when 1090 is violated is that the city kept the land, and they got their money back. So that's the penalty. And to most folks, that's just, you know, that's just the nuclear bomb penalty of, like, now you get nothing. Like, the city gets to keep it all. So keep in mind the 1090 violations. It's pretty strict. I was talking with some folks before this session about California has some strict rules. This is one of those where you just can't be contracting with the city. Presumably, you know, there's contracts that you can get in other jurisdictions, and if you're going to be serving in the city, then you shouldn't be contracting with the city in most cases. Next issue, future employment. So there's a revolving door prohibition. Basically, you can't become a paid lobbyist a year after your service with the city, and you're not supposed to participate in decisions involving potential future employers. And that's for obvious reasons that you're going to get sweetheart deals otherwise, or you might be tempted to. So best practices, avoid the temptation to look at public service as an opportunity for financial gain, and look at every decision and ask yourself whether it involves some kind of financial interest for you. And again, this is what I wanted to emphasize, and I think I have been. I don't think anyone in this room decided to work with the city and to be a public servant because they were hoping to get financial gain from it. In fact, you know, none of you are really being paid anything but a pittance for your service. You know, there's a lot of basically volunteer time involved. And so the issue is whether you inadvertently might get tripped up with some of these issues. And so just think, if your decision somehow could affect your pocketbook, positive or negative, that's a red flag. And you want to have the city attorney, city manager, city clerk take a look at it and make sure that you're okay. And if there's a disqualification you need to do, you need to abstain from decision, you know, we'll let you go ahead of time. So that was group one. And now for group two, perks. Your assistant city attorney, Brian Wright Bushman, will cover this session.
Okay, so in addition to the public expecting that you will act on their behalf without personal conflicts of interest, the public is also expecting that you are in your position in order to serve them and not just to get more benefit for yourself in terms of gifts or perks. So the rules we'll talk about here are primarily from the Political Reform Act, which apply to local officials, local elected officials, designated employees of local government officials, anyone required to fill out a Form 700, and also candidates for these positions. And before we get started on this, this is just another illustration of Chris's point. The rules in this area regarding gifts and other perks change a lot, and there's often exceptions and nuances to the rules. And so, again, the point here is not to memorize all these rules. You couldn't do that. But just to know and to kind of have a flag go off in your mind that, hey, maybe this is something I need to ask about. And then, again, ask early and ask often. The key principle here is, again, the public servants should not receive special benefits or perks just by virtue of their positions. You're supposed to be in your position to serve the public and not to basically line your pocketbook or get some extra benefits. Next slide. There's basically two kinds of perk rules for two different kinds of perks. One is perks that others offer you. We're primarily talking about gifts here. People may give things to you because, essentially, of your power you have to get things done for them. And the second is perks that you give yourself or use of public resources issues. Obviously, when you become a public official or a public figure, you have access to a new, basically to money and to resources of the local government, and you are entrusted to use those wisely and responsibly. So perks others offer or gifts. There are a couple main rules here, sort of bright line rules. First is that you are required to report any gift that you receive of $50 and up. So this is going to be reported on your Form 700. This applies to not just a single gift, but it's a cumulative effect. So if you receive, you know, five gifts of $10 each, then once you hit the $50 limit, that's when your requirement to report kicks in, and that's in a 12-month period. So that's the reporting requirement. The second is an absolute cap, so you may not receive gifts over $500 from any single individual in any single 12-month period. That $500 limit goes up usually every year or two. It's $500 is the current limit, though, for the 2019-2020 year. There are some exceptions. Yeah, sorry. Would it be helpful if I moved over? Yeah, especially for you, presumably. Yeah, let me see if I can do that. I don't want to block you guys either. You've got wheels, so this should be pretty easy.
He's going to make a great assistant, huh?
Yeah.
All right.
Can you see?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
And also, for those of you that may not have been able to see all the slides or would like to see them again, we can get you all copies of them if you'd like after the presentation. Okay, now there are some exceptions here. We'll talk in a minute more about what exactly constitutes a gift. There are some exceptions. Travel and informational materials are two examples. Not all kinds of travel. There are a couple kinds of travel. For example, when the city receives a donation and then that donation is used to pay for your travel, specifically for official business, then it's understood that the donation was primarily to the city and not to you personally, because the city is the one that chose where it goes, not the person that gave it. So that would be an example where you are getting a benefit, but it's not necessarily a gift that needs to be reported. There's also another exception for informational materials you may receive. That can include that could include free admission to a conference or a seminar, or brochures or pamphlets about your job. Another exception would be gifts from friends or family, as long as it's clear that those gifts are not given by people or in such a way that was trying to influence your political decision. They're not acting as an intermediary. For the real gift giver. And then also, as Chris talked about already, the public generally exception, any gift that or benefit that's available or a discount, I guess in this case, that's available to the general public. gifts, as Chris just talked about, may also be a disqualifying interest. So if you've received a gift in the last 12 months, that could be a reason that you would need to disqualify yourself from a decision. Okay, so just generally, gifts don't always have to have bows. So what is a gift? Right. So a gift is any payment or benefit, doesn't just have to be money, that confers a personal benefit for which the public official does not provide payment or services of equal or greater value. So it's not just getting something for free, right? So it's, and that's key. So if you get something but you get it half off, let's say if you get something that would have been $100 and someone gives it to you for $80, you've just received a $20 gift. Even though you paid something for it, you didn't pay full price. So you've now, in that scenario, you've received a $20 gift. So it's not just free stuff, and it's not just money. Also, a gift, it doesn't just have to be a gift to you personally either. So a gift to your family can also be a gift. So I was watching a television show recently, which I don't know if any of you have seen, called Parks and Recreation, but one of the guys is on the phone and he's saying, basically, I think he says something like, you know, why don't you just send those suits to my wife, and then if she doesn't like them, she can give them to me. So that is not a way to get around gift laws, to have someone give gifts to your spouse or to your child. If it's clear the gift was intended for you, which it would be if someone sent suits to your wife, it still is going to count as a gift to you. And going back to the slide, gifts can include meals, food, and drink. Entertainment, tickets to events, and certain kinds of travel and lodging. Most obviously travel for vacation or something like that. And you may find yourself in a position where you receive gifts that you did not necessarily want to receive, or that you didn't ask for. You may have a no-gift policy, for example, but people give you gifts anyway. So if a gift puts you over the limit, the $500 limit, that's okay. There's things you can do to basically to disavow the gift, to give it back. So you can either and the big timeline here is 30 days. So you can return the unused gift within 30 days to the person that gave it to you. You can reimburse the donor for the fair market value of the gift within 30 days. And if you do that, it'd probably be a good idea to put something in writing memorializing that you did that and how much you gave them. You can donate the gift to a charitable or governmental organization, so long as you don't claim a tax deduction. And if the gift was a free pass or a ticket to do something, then you can just simply not use it and also not let anyone else use it. So the mere fact of receiving it is not necessarily the thing that puts you over the limit. It's what you then do with it as well. Just to mention a few more exceptions due to the gift rules. We talked about gifts from friends or family, gifts that are or discounts that are available to the general public. Campaign contributions don't count as gifts because they're not the kind of thing that's supposed to be used by you personally. They're supposed to be used by your campaign. Obviously, there's other rules for campaign contributions, but it doesn't trigger the gift rules. Gifts that are given to you, like tickets specifically, in your ceremonial for a ceremonial role. So if you are asked to throw out the first pitch of the Dodger game and you're given a free ticket to the game, that's not a gift. There's also a nice category here called acts of neighborliness, which is refreshing. Sometimes we just do nice things for each other that we would normally do for people in the course of being good neighbors, and those things don't necessarily count as gifts either, as long as the extent of that gift or the proportion between what the service was or the kind act was and the relationship. Make it clear that it's not something that was really something that was politically motivated or something like that. Okay, on to the next slide, gifts and tickets. So tickets or passes are defined by the FPPC, the Fair Political Practices Commission, as admission to a facility, event, show, or performance for an entertainment, amusement, recreational, or similar purpose. So free tickets from the city usually donated to the city, generally are gifts subject to gift limits. And so sometimes the city will receive a set of free tickets or passes to something, and then they'll distribute them. And if that's the case, they would normally count as a gift. There are cases, however, in which tickets from the city do not count as a gift. So first, if they are reported by the city on Form 802, and they are either reported as income on taxes, or again, if they were part of your ceremonial role, like if you were given a ticket to throw out the first pitch. Again, if you were to give it back or to donate it. And then finally, there is something, and Morro Bay does not have one of these, but it could in the future, if there is essentially a policy in place that deals with this scenario where the gifts are distributed by the city on some kind of a random basis. So essentially the city in that case is running interference between the person that gave the gift and the people that are receiving the gift, so there's no way for the person who gave the gift to have to intentionally direct a benefit to a specific person in order to have an effect on that person. So my understanding is that Morbid doesn't currently have one of those policies, but it may in the future, so that would be another way to deal with the ticket or the free ticket issue. The next slide, gifts and family fun. So just to remind you again, the definition of gift includes gifts to your family. And there used to be a loophole for tuition where you could basically give someone's kid tuition if they were over 18, which would be a huge benefit. But that loophole has been closed. This does not apply to scholarships, however. So if your child is over 18 and receives a scholarship, that's not going to count as a gift to you. But if your child, if someone decided to pay your child's tuition, that would count as a gift. Okay, next slide, raffles and gift exchanges. So a raffle item, so if a private individual gave an item to a city for a city raffle, and then you entered the raffle and you received that gift, or the prize, I should say, that would count as income to you, and you would need to report it. There is a distinction to be made here, so when a third party donates the prize to the city and the city raffles it off, the employee who gets the raffle prize has to report it on the Form 700, and the amount of the gift is going to be the fair market value of the prize you got minus whatever it costs you to enter the raffle, if anything. But there is another possible scenario in which an employee of the city is the one who provided the prize, or maybe the city purchased the prize with its own funds. And if that's the case, then you don't need to report it as a gift. If you win the prize, you don't have to report the gift, because the city is not, I guess the presumption there is the city is not trying to influence the city, right? But if someone from outside the city is the one that gave the gift, then you need to report. Okay, some other perks to consider. Next slide. First of all, there's a special rule that you should take note of about transportation on a quote-unquote common carrier. I had a professor in law school that told me that all law, I can't remember if it was California law or federal law, but either way, goes back to the railroads. And this is an example where that might be the case. Evidently, at one point, the railroads loomed so large in our country that there was concern about politicians being influenced by being given free railroad tickets. So the concern was evidently so great that it is in the California Constitution that public officials may not receive free or discounted travel or shipping from a transportation carrier, so a plane, a train, a bus, or a car. This includes both personal and professional travel and travel for the city, so there's not many exceptions there. The only exceptions are, again, for these things that are available generally to the public, so things like frequent flyer miles are okay, and other discounts that might be available to the general public. Now, if some private individual were to buy you a plane ticket that would be different and could create other problems, but that wouldn't be this rule. This rule applies to the carrier itself giving you a free pass or a discount. Now, the thing to pay attention to here is that the penalty here is very stiff. It's forfeiture of office. So this seems potentially disproportional now. Maybe it seemed more proportional at the time when the power of the railroads was looming large. But nonetheless, it is still the rule. So if you are ever receiving discounted or free travel, ask yourself who you are receiving it from and make sure you think hard about it and probably should ask our office or the FPPC or someone, because the penalty is stiff. The second rule on this slide, no honoraria or fees for speaking or writing. The idea here is, first, non-honoraria, so the definition is a payment received for giving a speech, writing an article, or attending a public or private conference or convention or some other meeting. So no elected office holder, candidate for elected office, or designated employee may accept an honoraria. The idea here is that if you get invited to speak at something specifically because of your position or your inside info about the city or whatever it is, that's supposed to just be part of your basically your job duties as a public official. You are to be responsible for informing the city about what's going on as part of your services without receiving extra compensation for that. If you do receive an honoraria again, if someone might pay you, they might send you a check after you've come and given the speech, it's something you really didn't ask for it. Again, you can just send it back to the 30-day rule we talked about. There are a few exceptions for this. Someone may say, in lieu of giving you an honorarium, I'm going to make a donation to a charity. That would be fine. If you tell them, if you specifically requested that, that would be different. But if they voluntarily do that, then they are allowed, that's fine. That doesn't count as an honoraria that you're receiving. Also, if it's just part of your professional duties and your job outside of your public office to give speeches from time to time, which it very well may be, and you happen to get paid for those speeches, that's not this. So you are allowed to continue to get payment for giving speeches as part of your normal profession outside of your city business. Okay, so just to give some case studies here. And the point of these case studies is a few things. First, to say people are paying attention to these things, and you might think that there are some things that are pretty minor. Like, is someone really going to care if I don't report something that was $60, even though it's just $10 over the limit, or whatever? And the answer is yes. At least sometimes they do. And sometimes they even go to great lengths to find people who are doing those things. So don't think just because, it's small money or something that no one will care or no one will see. So in this first case study, Stone and Youngberg, in 2014, there was an FPPC investigation. Again, the FPPC is a California Fair Political Practices Commission. They're the people that enforce the Political Reform Act. They did an investigation that uncovered that hundreds of public officials had accepted meals, baseball tickets, brownies, other gifts from a bond finance company and failed to disclose them. So, brownies is on the list. So you might think, they just gave me some brownies. But if you got a lot of brownies, I'm imagining maybe this must have been a gift basket or something. I don't know. But somehow it was over the limit, at least the reportable limit. Most of the offenders, 167 officials, accepted gifts valued between $50 and $100. So we're talking small money here. And they were issued warning letters advising them to adhere to the state reporting requirements. There were 93 other officials who failed to report gifts and meals worth $100 or more. And they were subject to fines of $200 for every year that they failed to report gifts. So in addition to pointing out that even small money can matter, it's also worth noting that it's probably not a huge deal to get a $200 fine. It's hard, it's a couple parking tickets. But to have your name in the paper next to violation of FPPC rules under a, you know, you can imagine whatever the article heading might be, would obviously do a lot more than $200 of damage to you and to the city. On the next slide, another 2013 case study. It was another incident in which nearly 200 public officials failed to report gifts from income or from investment bankers. The FPPC issued $24,000 in fines. And again, just about the small money nature of this. One of the people received a ticket to a Padres game and a meal at Petco Park worth $40 and $20. $20, two months later. So I mean, this guy was up to then $60 combined and didn't report it. And nonetheless, he was one of the people who was caught. Next slide, penalties for political form act violations. So fines of up to $1,000 per violation. You may have to pay your own attorney's fees plus attorney's fees of anyone who brings a suit against you and wins. You can lose your office. You can be banned from holding future office. You could get up to 6 months in jail. So nothing to be taken lightly.
If you speak at a dinner and you're giving a free dinner, that certainly should not matter, I would expect.
I believe that if you are asked to come to an event to speak and you are given admission to the event and you receive dinner at the event, those do not violate the honorarium rule. Chris, do you know if those would count as gifts?
It depends on what you're doing there.
Okay. So if you were there, are you imagining that you were invited there specifically to speak?
Yeah, so on some city issue, you're asked to come clarify what's going on with WRF. The Cal group invites you there and you explain some things. They buy you lunch when they have their weekly lunch meeting on Friday. And something like that, I would expect.
It would probably be best to go ahead and just listen on their Form 700, because I doubt that that group or any group is going to exceed $500 in meals. And so, I mean, we could always look into it to see if there's an exception, but regularly, you report it if it's over $50. But, presumably the meal might not be...
Too many meals over 50.
Yeah, I mean, if the meal's, worth less than 50, then don't worry about it. But if you have four meals that are each worth, $15, then you would report it.
Okay, so we were talking about gifts, perks that other people give you. Now we're going to talk about the use of public resources. So, in other words, perks you sort of give yourself. So, again, the rule here is that the personal use of public resources is prohibited. So, public resources include public money, public staff time, public equipment, public supplies. Examples of this might be using a city vehicle for personal errands, using city office equipment for a political campaign. There are several potential ways to violate this. One thing to note here, too, is you might think, well, okay, I'm just going to do this, and then if I get caught, it can't be that much money, so I'll just pay him back or something like that. So reimbursing the city for the resources that you've illegally used is not a defense to a violation of this. So don't be tempted by that one. There is a... Lest you be overly concerned, there is a limited exception for incidental and minimal use. So if you make a personal phone call from time to time, you're not going to get a call from the FPPC. If you print out your flight itinerary, I don't think the FPPC is going to come call you. But beyond things like that, definitely think about it. Another issue on the next slide is expense reimbursement. So this is another area where you're paying the money up front, so it's not that you have access to money that you didn't necessarily spend, but once you start asking for reimbursement beyond what you're actually entitled to, then you are dipping into public funds illegally. So you should familiarize yourself with your agency's policies. Morro Bay should have a reimbursement policy that you can get a copy of and look at, what exactly is reimbursable. The general rule is that anything
that is actual and necessary to the performance of your duties would be reimbursable. But if you have questions, you should ask. This may go without saying, but just in case it doesn't, if you happen to be traveling with your spouse or your child or your friend or something like that, then the expenses that are added to your trip by the presence of your spouse or your children or whoever are not are not reimbursable, just the cost for yourself.
Why don't we go ahead and take a break right now? I know it's a little bit past four, so we'll take a 10-minute break.
Just to remind you where we're at, we're in the middle of discussion of perks. We talked about gifts,
the perks other people give you. Now we're talking about illegal use of public resources, which are the perks you give yourself. We talked about reimbursements and general use of public resources. Just to give a few case studies, we won't go into detail on these, but just to say there have been some serious problems in the state, and some of which led to the creation of this requirement for you to be here today regarding reimbursements. Things like double dipping, charging, some people who, for example, there was a member of multiple water districts in LA County who would go out to dinner and incur various expenses for meals, taking people out to dinner, and then he would charge the cost of whatever it was to both agencies that he worked on, for example, which obviously was not his actual costs, but was in fact double them. There have been people who have for example, a council member in Colton, California, arrested on suspicion of charging thousands of dollars to the city for motel rooms and phone calls. He ended up being charged with 24 felony counts of misappropriation of public funds. So you may think that reimbursements, reimbursements are not, not a big deal or not somewhere you would do this, but it happens, and it happens to the tune of thousands and thousands of dollars. And people get indicted on felony counts for this kind of thing. Next slide, political use of public resources. One more place where it might be tempting and yet still illegal to give yourself a perk would be to benefit your own political career aspirations. So public funds cannot be used to expressly advocate for or against a candidate or a measure, a proposition, ballot measure. Another area where this can come into play is the mass mailing rule. The mass mailing rule, it's complicated and there are some exceptions, but just so you have the general sense of it in your head so you can ask your questions. The general rule is that no newsletter or other mail or mass mailing can be sent at public expense. A mass mailing is a technical term. It's 200 or more substantially similar tangible items. So we're not talking about emails. We're not talking about putting something on social media. We're talking about actual things that are physically sent out. It's 200 that are sent in the same month. And importantly, they have to feature an elected official. So we're talking about their picture, their signature, or maybe their name is specifically signaled out, highlighted, bold font, larger font, whatever it is, and that mailing is paid for with public funds. The idea here is that is to prevent incumbents having an advantage. It may seem innocuous for the city to send things out, and often it is, but that's also a way to get your face in front of the public, and the FPPC realizes that. So it's not to say you can't send anything out, but if you are sending things above 200 items within a month that are singling out a particular person, you will be in violation of the mass mailing rule. So if that is something you have that you may have some involvement in, just ask some questions and make sure you're doing it right. Finally, there is a constitutional prohibition of making a gift of public funds. This can take various forms, but just generally know the use of public funds is to go to public purposes. It's not to go to private purposes. Sometimes the use of public funds has incidental value to private parties, but the purpose, the primary purpose, is supposed to be for the public. So if you find yourself doing something with public funds, or even approving some use of public funds, and it seems to you like, man, we're really just giving this to a private party. This doesn't really have any public value or purpose. That should raise a red flag in your head, and you should ask questions. Finally, best practices. Generally, avoid perks and the temptation to rationalize about them. You may think, you know, it's... I don't know. I can imagine Chris went through the list of rationalizations. It may be tempting. Sometimes it may seem like it's just a very small dollar amount. Sometimes it may think that no one will know. The examples we've gone through, I hope, show you that doesn't matter how small the dollar amount. The FPPC cares, and they make efforts to catch people. Again, just whenever you get some, whether you know whether you've paid for it or you've paid a discounted price for it, just ask yourself, is this a gift? This line of questioning should go off in your head now. Is this a gift? Am I allowed to receive this? Do I need to report this? And am I over the limit? And then finally, we're going to keep driving this point home. When to ask for help. So whenever you have doubts, so ask early, ask often. We will walk you through any of the nuances or the details of it. So now we're on to section 3, which is transparency laws, and we're going to give it back to Chris.
I wanted to clarify something before going into transparency laws. So when I talked about Government Code Section 1090 and contracts, to be clear, it's if you're the decision maker of the contract that your business or financial interest can't do a contract with the city. So usually this applies to council members. And if you're on a commission or a staff that's involved in the contract, you can step back from just being involved and the contract can still occur. So I didn't want there to be any misunderstanding with that. It's not that everybody in this room can never have any contract with the city. It's if you actually make the decision on whether that contract is entered into, which almost always is city council, or if you're involved in the negotiations, setting out the terms, et cetera. So I wanted to clarify. I didn't want there to be a misunderstanding on that. Yes?
Involved in setting out the terms. Okay. So you're a contractor. The city asks you to do something. You give them your terms. By definition, you're involved in the terms. So I'm still confused.
No, what I mean is that if you actually, as a city agent, are negotiating with the vendor or the business person, if you are the person, then you're negotiating on the side of the private party. But, you know, that's a really good example of you can't hand the city your terms and then run around the other side, take the terms, and go, hey, now, you know, these, I accept them all, you know. I mean, you know, and then recommend to council that they approve the contract. You have to negotiate as a third party. You can't use any of your authority or power to influence it. And then, of course, if you actually are approving or disapproving the contract, which in almost all cases is city council or city manager, then you just can't be involved at all. Does that make sense? Okay. So transparency laws. This is the third section. We're about two-thirds through all of this. The other one's got a little bit more time. Transparency laws involve Form 700s, which you all have or should be filing within 1 year of taking office, and those list your financial interests in the city. There's nothing wrong with having financial interests in the city. It's just simply the public can pull those documents and see how it might impact your decisions. The Brown Act, which we'll talk about, and then the Political Reform Act. So key principles is it's the public's business, and the public trusts a process it can see. So transparency rules. two big rules, and you're going to hear these thrown around a lot if you haven't already. Public Records Act. Basically, the presumption is every document at City Hall is available to the public unless there's an exception or a privilege. So as attorneys, we deal a lot with Public Records Act requests, and our city clerk deals with them 100%. They go to her first, and sometimes they come to us for legal analysis, and the police department deals with them a lot too. The presumption is everything is public unless there's an exception or privilege, and basically it's meant to ensure that there aren't secret files at City Hall. But there are times when the documents are not released. And then there's the Brown Act. Open meeting laws. This governs how meetings are conducted. And the general idea is that you want to make sure the public can see and hear when the decisions are made and also the process leading to the decision. And that's often where issues occur, is leading up to the decision, making sure that the discussions among the decision makers are public. So next slide, public records. What are public records? Like I said, presumption is everything at City Hall is a public record, unless there's an exception. This includes agendas and meeting materials, writings prepared, owned, used, or retained by the agency, including electronic, and penalties can be costs and fees, bad media attention on the city, and also if an attorney sues the city saying they withheld public records, the city has to pay their attorney's fees if they win. Some of the exemptions, though, are if it involves litigation and it would affect the city's ability to engage in litigation, the records aren't released. There's privacy exemptions. Routinely, you'll see, for example, Social Security numbers blacked out, phone numbers blacked out. There's a lot of personnel file exemptions. The public doesn't have the right. In most cases, the law has been changing lately a bit, but in most cases, to look at law enforcement files, personnel, a lot of city employment personnel files, etc. In fact, there's a list of, I think it's 54 that are in the government code itself, and then a bunch of other ones courts have come up with. And that's why public records can get kind of messy when you're deciding what should be released and what shouldn't. But we start with the presumption everything at City Hall is a public record. Next slide, financial interest disclosure. Transparency includes the obligation for basically all public servants to disclose their financial interests, and that requires filling out the Form 700, which basically lists financial interests in the city, and it's there for the public to look at and just see what might be influencing your decision. You do it when you enter office, you do it annually, and you do it when you leave office. Next slide, charitable fundraising. This is a rule that only really you need to worry about is if you are able to get $5,000 or more donated to the city at your request. If so, you simply need to fill out a form. This is something that often isn't understood by a lot of folks because it doesn't get triggered a lot. But if you have enough influence to get $5,000 or more dollars donated to the city for something, then you need to fill out, there needs to be a form 803 filled out on that.
If I can just add one thing to that also, if you work on the board of a nonprofit foundation and you are involved in fundraising for that nonprofit, you might, this might apply as well. I mention that only because I work with a couple of nonprofits that council members are on.
Thank you, Brian. So best practices. A question? Yeah.
There we go. Sorry not to take too much time on this, but if you are on the board of a nonprofit and you're involved in the donations, if the nonprofit as a whole is soliciting the funds, then that's not a problem. But depending on how the literature goes out, the solicitation literature goes out from your board, if it is singling you out and you are a politician or you are a public official and it's singling you out, so it appears, or maybe you're just making phone calls on behalf of the nonprofit or the charitable organization, and so it could be clearly shown that you specifically have led to the donation of at least $5,000 to the entity, then that would be a behested payment, which could trigger a reporting requirement.
This also only applies to elected officials.
Elected.
Yeah, elected. Yeah, not appointed. Yeah, so that probably clarifies maybe 9 out of 10 or more questions on this. So best practices in regards to public information and public records, just assume every document in City Hall will be public if somebody asks for it. And so there, like I said, are a lot of exceptions, but the general rule is just assume all information is public or will become public. And then also for the Brown Act, don't discuss agency business with fellow decision makers outside meetings, which we'll get into now with the Brown Act. So in the next slide, Brown Act is the open meeting laws. I'm sure you've all heard of the Brown Act. And it's basically the idea that we don't make secret decisions. And so all of the rules in the Brown Act are geared towards transparency on the decisions made and how they're made. And how they're made is the big part. So on the next slide, conducting business at open meetings. Basically, a majority of the commission or council can't consult amongst themselves outside of a properly noticed meeting. And the public has the right to see how, if you will, the sausage is made. They get to be there while discussion occurs. And the key concept here is that there can be something that's called a serial meeting. Now, a serial meeting is when you have a meeting that is occurring in slow motion, where one commissioner, Commissioner 1, talks to Commissioner 2, Commissioner 2 talks to Commissioner 3, Commissioner 3 talks to Commissioner 4, and it occurs over the course of 5 weeks. Just because you're not all having coffee together and making a decision before the meeting doesn't mean you can't do a slow motion serial meeting. And so that's prohibited. And then there are a number of exceptions, too. We're almost there, Brian. All right. Okay. And then, perfect. And then there are a number of exceptions, too, for the Brown Act prohibition on basically a majority or a quorum of your commission or council meeting together. You actually can go to a conference or event that's put on by an organization other than the city, and you can all be present. You can talk about sports, the weather, national politics, all you want. You could all be at a party together and, you know, be all 5 or 7 of you together, you know, the whole night. But I want to emphasize this is where perception versus reality comes into play. I'd strongly advise all of you on commissions and the council to not have a majority of you congregating together and talking outside of the meeting, because the public will always say, oh, well, what were they talking about? You know, like, what was really going on over there? And so the reality is that people talk about you can link up with a minority of people on your commission or council. You know, you can have one other person you talk about the business that comes before you, but you don't want a majority, you know, regularly interacting outside of the noticed meeting. So the next slide, what is a meeting? Like I said, it's just a gathering a majority of the members of the body to hear, discuss, or deliberate upon items that come before them. You can talk about weather, sports, and your, you know, funny cat videos or the surf down at the beach, you know, anything you want, but just not the decisions that you're going to be making. And next slide, what is a meeting? Emphasizing it, it's any means of communication. So it can be email, it can be circular letters, if those ever occur anymore these days. It can be friends, like passing messages. You basically can't do secret decision making. On the next slide, what is a meeting? Again, it's where a quorum receives information on, discusses or deliberates on any item on which your body can legally act. And that meeting must be held within the boundaries of the agency. And generally, you need to have your agendas put out 72 hours ahead of time. But you can also have special meetings where there's 24-hour notice. And what is not a meeting? As I mentioned before, individual contact, public conferences, and it's interesting to note that, you know, today we actually noticed this as technically a meeting, and we did it 72 hours ahead of time because we wanted to comply with the Brown Act, because there's a potential for a majority of your commissions or councils to be in this room. So it's open to the public. Technically, it's been noticed as a meeting because even though it's a conference, the city's holding it. If it's the county or another group, you can all be there. Other local agency meetings, that's not a meeting. Community gatherings, social gatherings. Next slide, agenda requirements. Basically, you need a written agenda for each meeting, and you need to have a short summary of the items you're going to talk about and maybe take action on. Next slide, stay on point. This comes up often. Basically, you're limited to talking at length about what's on the agenda. And there's a good reason for this. If the public has the right to see how the sausage is made, like how you're making your decisions, what decisions are being made, then the only decisions you make and the big discussions you have need to be on that agenda. Otherwise, they don't know you're going to be doing it. They don't know if they should show up or not. There can be, you know, a few minutes of discussion on items that go off agenda, especially questions of staff, brief responses to the public. But you can't have any significant discussion if it's not on the agenda. And that brings me to the next slide, agenda requirements, the exceptions. Brief responses, statements or questions, questions for clarification, reference to staff. Or you can request staff to report on something at a subsequent meeting, and then it would be on the agenda, so then the public would know that's going to be occurring there. Next slide, public participation in meetings. Anyone could attend the meetings. This has been an interesting issue that we've seen develop recently under the new mayor on that the law says that you can't require people to give their name, fill out questionnaires, or have any conditions to attend. And Mayor Hettings emphasized a lot at the meetings that you're welcome to not state your name, but it's going to be hard to keep you in the record with your name if you don't say what it is. But you don't have to say your name. The right to anonymous speech is protected. You can record. If someone shows up, they can record it. And really the only rule is you can't disrupt the meeting so much that it prevents the meeting from occurring. And there are a lot of court cases out there that protect the right of the public to show up and to talk and to be at meetings. So that's definitely a First Amendment right. Next slide, closed sessions. Notwithstanding, almost all decisions need to be made in public. Often we'll have closed sessions noticed. Usually it's just for city council. Occasionally planning commission might do it once in a blue moon. Some of the other boards might do it too, or commissions. But a closed session is where the public can't be part of the decision making because there's usually an adversarial relationship. And if the other side hears what's going on, your hand's tipped. And so they know what you're talking about. So this involves litigation, purchase of real property, and then also personnel and labor issues. Otherwise, it needs to be at a public meeting. Next slide on closed sessions. Confidentiality applies. And once a decision is made, a final decision where all parties have agreed, then it needs to be announced in open session. And then next slide, Brown Act, penalties failing to comply. The decision can be nullified. And if somebody believes there was a Brown Act violation, then they need to notice the city either within 90 or 30 days of the alleged complaint. And then the city has an opportunity to cure it, if you will, to basically redo the decision, or else they can go to court. So that's group three. And now we're going to move on to group four, fair process laws. And your assistant city attorney, Brian, will take it from here.
Okay, so you all heard Chris talk earlier about the difference between acting as basically a legislator on one hand and sort of like a judge on the other. Sometimes those are talked about as your legislative capacity versus your judicial or quasi-judicial capacity. You probably just think of yourself as one person doing a set of things, which are called your job, you know, or your public duties. But it's helpful to at least think of yourselves as potentially wearing one of two hats. One of those hats, if, and this may not apply to all of you, just depends on what your powers and responsibilities are, but one of your hats is to make laws, right, or to make rules that will apply generally to the public, to anyone who falls under the umbrella of that rule. You might think about this as making policy as well. And when you're doing those things, you're acting in your legislative capacity. You're making laws. You're making rules that will generally apply. On the other hand, you will sometimes be asked to make a decision about a specific permit, or an item may come to your board on appeal, in which case you are applying those general laws to a specific person or a specific business or a specific scenario, someone probably who has applied for something and feel that they have complied with the requirements that are set up for that application and would like you to tell them or to make a decision about whether or not they have indeed complied with those requirements and probably what conditions you are going to put on the approval of that application. When you're doing those things, you're acting a lot more like a judge than you are like a legislature. And in those capacities, there's often more formalities. It's not going to feel like you're in a courtroom, but it's going to feel more like you're in a courtroom than if you were just acting in the normal capacity of maybe setting some new policy or making a new law. So just think about yourself as potentially wearing one of those two hats.
If I could, examples of that, legislative examples are when you adopt an ordinance, city council would be doing that. Purchases of property, awarding of contracts, or if you're making a recommendation for those actions to the city council. And then the other one, the quasi-judicial, as we call it, that would be like a discretionary land use permit, business license, or other actions where basically you're applying the rules, as Brian said, to a specific property owner or specific person. And there's differences in the bias you might have, how due process works, which Brian's going to talk about.
And we're specifically going to talk about the side when you're acting in this quasi-judicial capacity. When you're acting in a legislative capacity, everyone understands that your values and your biases and your strong-held positions are going to come to bear. That's very likely why you were elected in the first place or appointed, because you have these views. And if an item is challenged before a court, the court is going to assume that you had good reason for the decision you made. If there is, however, a case in which you are asked to make one of these quasi-judicial decisions, there's going to be a bit more scrutiny on you, and that's why we're talking about this. You need to know that your decision will be scrutinized a bit more because there are more elements of fairness that come into play. You can imagine as a resident of this community, if someone makes a law over it, you will feel it personally, but you will feel it roughly equally to everyone else around you. But then if you can sort of imagine yourself coming before a group of people, small group of people, 5 people, 7 people, whatever it is, and saying that you want this specific thing for your specific property or your specific business, you will very likely feel that a lot more. And you will, I would think that you would demand a higher standard of fairness. You would care a lot more about what each individual on that board is thinking, and you would really want to make sure that even if they disagree with you or don't vote for your approval, that they would have at least considered it objectively and fairly to the extent possible. And that's what we're talking about here. So Chris went into some good detail on financial biases, and those still apply, obviously. But there are also some non-financial biases that you should be aware of. So just because you don't have a financial bias doesn't mean that you are therefore an objective and fair decision maker. You can have other kinds of biases or conflicts. So the first kind is just having a personal interest in the decision's outcome. So this is one example would be if this a decision about property and if the property is developed, it's going to block the view from your house or something like that. So that that also may create some kind of a financial conflict. But even putting that aside, it's just going to affect your quality of life, and that is a personal potential source of bias. Second, just a straightforward personal bias. You may just have a known animus against someone in the community, or they may have a known animus against you. I hope that's not the case, but I'm sure it's happened to somebody. And so if And it may, in fact, be known to the public that there is animosity between people. If that is the case, you will need to ask yourself whether you could make a fair decision about an application that person would bring before you. And you should also ask yourself whether or not if somebody in the public or perhaps an objective party in a court of law looked at this decision and knew the background and knew what had been publicly said or maybe put in the papers or whatever, if they would believe that you could really make an objective decision about this application that's come before you. And then finally, there's a factual bias. The idea here is that someone who comes before you, they have an interest in making sure that all the relevant facts are made part of the discussion that night or that day. And so if it then comes out later that, you know, basically everyone heard this set of facts, but there were also some facts over here that one particular person got told about and no one else knew about those things, and it really seems like they probably made the decision based on those things, that's really not fair, because the point of a public hearing is to give the applicant an opportunity to respond to all the potentially negative points against his or her application, for example. And so if it turns out the decision was really made on the basis of something that didn't even come up that night, that again is a way that the process could be unfair. Sometimes these are called ex parte contacts. That just means communications or contacts with a decision maker that happen outside the context of the meeting where the decision is made. Yes?
We often say that we have had an ex parte conversation, but we usually do not go into the specifics of what that conversation was. How deeply do we need to do that in order to avoid factual bias?
Yeah, I'm going to defer to Chris on that.
So the saying that you had an ex parte contact is sometimes enough. If there's new information you received that you think is going to influence your decision, or you think that the other members of the council or the commission should hear, then I would advise that you report then that information. But a common example of ex parte contact is if you might go out to a site to visually look around at something. Well, just saying I went to the site, you don't need to describe, you know, what you necessarily saw unless you believe that there's some discrepancy with the report that's coming before the council. And, you know, maybe there's an assumption that, you know, the site has been well maintained and you go out there and it's just a jungle. Well, you know, that might influence your decision. So you would say, and when I went to the site, you know, it did not look like at all what I'd been told. But if you just are going out there to just, you know, give it a look-see and, you know, everything seems to be okay, then you don't need to go into all those facts.
This can also be to your advantage to make sure it's clear what you are basing your decision off of, because if it gets challenged and you had good grounds for the decision you made, but none of that information appears in the record, then a court may find that, you know, may decide based on what they see in front of them that there really wasn't good grounds for the decision, even if there was. On the next slide, due process equals fair process. We have a couple of cases here. I'll spare you the details of those, but except maybe to read the quote, a councilman has a right to state his views on matters of community policy, and his vote may not be impeached because he does so. I think the point here is just to point out, this is one of those cases Chris was talking about where reality is basically as important as perception. Again, you are a decision maker, you are a public figure, and the reason you are in your position may well be because you have been a strong advocate of that position, which is a great thing. But a court and also the court of public opinion is going to look at whether or not the process seems fundamentally fair. So without, you know, I'm not saying to completely hide your views, but it will be, I think, best for the process if you hold very strong views about something to at least approach a decision and the sort of prior events to, coming up to the decision without loudly proclaiming a view which will make it seem as though you have already prejudged this and already know how you will vote and that you are not open to any new information that may come before you on the night of the decision. Because doing that will will give the public and potentially then later a court of law the sense that you had really already made up your mind and the process wasn't fair.
Also, on that note, it's not that one is incapable of reversing, changing their mind. I mean, presumably we all have open minds. But once you've publicly stated how you're going to vote on something or, you know, what your view is on it, it's a lot harder than to then publicly change your mind. You know, privately you might have reservations about something. You know, privately you might, you know, already think, well, you know, I hope I hear something good. I think I know how I'm going to vote on this one. But if you publicly state it, then it's a lot harder personally to backtrack on that. And so that's also the reason there, too, assuming we all have open minds. So that's something to keep in mind as well.
And basically the outcome, and maybe just to point to an example, you've probably all, or if any of you are inclined to follow when Supreme Court justices get appointed, they always get asked about, like, how would you decide this if this came before you? And if they are smart at all, they always say, I'm not going to discuss how I would decide on a particular issue because that may actually come before me, and I'm not going to tip my hat to tell you how I would vote because then it will appear that I am not capable of changing my mind on this. Or
even though we all probably know how they're going to vote.
Right.
They just don't say it.
That's right. And those people are obviously known to have biases, and they have a whole history of cases they've already decided. But still, the wisdom is you don't say how you would decide a case before it comes to you. And the outcome of doing so can be that a judge could find that the process was not fair and could require a new vote on the issue without your presence in that vote. Fair process laws continued. So, like I just said, disqualification or what? Yes. Yeah, so you may need to disqualify yourself in some context. Disqualification requirement if decision involves your family members. So just another potential source of bias. There may not be a financial bias, but it could have just an effect on your family or your family members, and that could be another reason why the decision could not be made fairly by you. Chris mentioned this rule about campaign contribution restrictions. This is a fairly convoluted rule, and you can ask more questions about it if it seems unclear. But basically the idea is if you are on the Planning Commission and you are running for council, so follow me through the steps here. You're running for council, someone contributes money to your council campaign, and then that contributor comes before you when you are still a Planning Commission member. You need to disqualify yourself. However, if that contributor comes, if you get elected to the council and then that person comes before you and you are a council member, you do not need to disqualify yourself. So this is, I don't know how likely this is to happen. It's fairly convoluted, but it is a rule. So just be aware if you are on the Planning Commission and you are soliciting funds for a campaign to get on city council, you may run into a case where these campaign contributions could lead to some kind of requirement to disqualify yourself. I see that I skipped a slide on incompatible offices and competitive bidding. Sorry about that. I'll just touch on them briefly as we're just about to time. Just know that there are certain offices that are incompatible and you can't hold them both at the same time. Basically, if one is overseeing the other or if the constituencies that you represent may potentially be at odds with one another, then you cannot hold both of those. And the rule is that when you get appointed to or sworn into the new office, you're automatically removed from the former office. So if you are about to, if you've been appointed or elected to a position and you're about to take the oath and you think, oh, I'm also on this other board and it seems like either one is overseeing the other or they could have some conflict, ask a question. And finally, on competitive bidding, as I'm sure most of you are aware, the city sometimes has a lot of leniency in how it can do its purchasing, but sometimes doesn't. There are state law and local law through the city's purchasing ordinance that dictate how the city does its purchasing, especially in the context of public works. You should just know that those are out there, and the general rule in public works is that you need to award contracts to the lowest responsible bidder, and if you don't, those contracts can be voided. So I'll give it back to Chris to wrap up.
All right. Well, good timing. We had our default reset, so let me run on to the end here. And also following up on the competitive bidding, so Public Works, as Brian was saying, there's state law that basically just black letter law you have to follow. So that's why you have Public Works bidding that is so done so. There's so many steps involved with Public Works. When it comes to supplies and equipment, cities generally have their own local code that affects supplies and equipment. And Morro Bay has one. When it comes to professional services, because it's usually something where, you know, it's a qualitative thing and not a quantitative difference, professional services aren't always subject to competitive bidding. So I wanted to be clear on that. If you're wondering, like, how did that contract get awarded, how did it not, Public Works is the strictest, and then supplies and equipment, there's always local law, and then professional services, it can often be at the discretion of the decision maker because they're assessing not necessarily quantitative issues. You know, with Public Works, usually you have multiple companies that can do the same job, so it's whoever can do it cheaper. With professional services, it's at the other end of the extreme. And then also for incompatible offices, the classic example is you can't be on Planning Commission and City Council at the same time. I mean, that's what we're talking about for incompatible offices. So best practices, think fairness and merit-based decisions, making in your decisions. Keep politics separate from your relationships with agency staff. And avoid committing or commenting before a public hearing on an item. And we have other resources that if you want to look into this, like I said, the Institute for Local Government has a lot of publications, and also the FPPC has other publications. And I think one of the best questions to ask yourself, again, I don't expect anybody to be an expert on this after the two-hour session, but ask yourself when you're making a decision or if there's a potential conflict that comes before you and you're wondering, you know, should I talk to the attorney? Should I disqualify myself? Like, what should I do here? If you're comfortable with there being a front page story in the local press on what you are contemplating doing and you're fine with that, then you're probably okay. But if you're thinking that this is not something I'd want a headline on, maybe there's an issue. And so that's the front page test. It's a good way to look at an issue. And also, how do you want to be remembered at the end of the day? You know, when it's all said and done and your public service is wrapped up at some point, you know, do you want the community that you live in and that you're a part of to think, you know, I really was happy that they served, you know, they did a lot of good for the city? Or do you want it to be questionable or not? And obviously we all want the former. And wrapping up, going back to the beginning, we've talked about some legal rules. Your own ethical standards, your own moral compass, of course, hopefully is going to be more than just the law, and I encourage you to apply that as well. It's your choice how high you want to set your own moral and ethical standards for your public service, but there are legal rules as well, which we've gone over today. And that concludes the session. You'll have sign-up sheets that you can fill out, certificates. Please turn them in to the city clerk, and we'll see you all again in about 2 years. And thank you for your service. Unfortunately, state law requires 2 hours, so. All right, let me get this. Okay.
I'll do the PowerPoint if you want. Am I do it?
Oh, yeah. All
right, welcome to AB 1234 training. We're going to be talking today for 2 hours, and it will be an exciting 2 hours, I want you to know. We got two presenters here. We'll take a break in an hour, try to make it as interesting as possible. We're talking about ethics laws and the legal requirements in the state of California that apply to ethics and conflicts of interest in your duties as public servants. And this is required by state law. And so what we're going to be doing in the session objectives on the first slide is we want to familiarize you with laws that govern your service and when to ask questions. And we want to encourage you to think beyond the legal restrictions, provide tools for doing so, and also help you comply with AB 1234 requirements. Now, while we do this presentation, feel free to raise your hand, ask any questions if you want. And the first issue I wanted to address was, what does AB 1234 mean? For what it's worth, that's Assembly Bill 1234. It was passed in the 80s after some big scandals where there were some perceived conflicts of interest. And Sacramento said, from now on, all elected officials and appointed officers need to have 2 hours of training to make sure that they know about the state laws and to address the different requirements. So the session objectives on the next slide, we have specified content that the California Attorney General has us required to cover, and the issue is to go more over a lot of different issues rather than drill down on any particular one, and not expecting you to be some expert after this. It's more of, after this training, you should be able to have some sort of gut check or red flag that comes up if there's some issue that involves your public service that perhaps involves a legal issue or some ethical issue, and you'll either know what to do, or more accurately, you'll ask the city attorney or city manager or city clerk, how should I deal with this situation? And then after you're done, there's sign-in certificates, and you'll provide them to the city clerk. So ethics laws versus ethics. Law is the starting point for ethical analysis, and the law is what we must do. But by no means am I here today to talk to you about what your personal ethical standard should be. I'm not here to teach you ethics. I'm not here to give you a moral compass. I'm not here to tell you the difference between right and wrong. The focus is on the laws that deal with ethics and how to make sure you're in compliance with those. And these rules are meant to be a starting point, minimum standards, ones that keep you legally compliant. But the assumption is that you have your own ethical standard and moral compass already, and that you'll be applying that above and beyond the legal requirements. So on the next slide, the California Attorney General says there's four basic areas that we're supposed to cover today, which is trustworthiness, respect, responsibility, and fairness. And so the next slide on rate yourself. So a little exercise I like to do. You don't have to tell us, but in your head, think, how do you rate yourself ethically? Are you always ethical, mostly, somewhat, seldom, or never? We all have that in our heads? Okay, next slide. How would other people rate you? Now, this is the mental exercise, because I want to illustrate that often in public service, the issue is public perception more so than the reality of what has occurred. Because for local government to work, we have to make sure that people believe and trust in their government, or else things start to break down. So often we have to do extra to make sure that the public perceives that we're doing the right thing. And so often the issue is how the public is looking at what's going on. And it's not just enough to know that you're following the law, but to make sure there's transparency and the public's aware that the law is being followed and that ethical standards are being adhered to. So on the next slide, rationalizations for unethical conduct. I'm sure we all like to think that we're ethical, and I assume everybody is in the room. But sometimes there's some slippery situations where, you know, you fall into the gray zone and you might justify quasi-unethical conduct. And there's different reasons why this can happen. It's human nature. It was necessary. The ends justify the means. It was legal. It won't hurt anyone. Can't be wrong. Everyone's doing it. It's okay. I didn't gain personally. I deserve it, or I'm only fighting fire with fire. These are rationalizations, but at the end of the day, if it's unethical conduct, it remains unethical conduct. And think about that, because you're going to have decisions you're making as public servants that you're going to want to make sure you apply both the legal standards, and also we'd encourage you to apply your own ethical and moral rules as well.
So in the next slide, public service ethics is different. Like I was saying before, the purpose of ethics laws is to protect the public's trust in the institutions and the individuals that serve them. And so perception can be as important as reality. And your gut is not always a reliable guide. Better to err on the side of caution. And one of the few takeaway points I want to emphasize today is, if in doubt, send it out. And what that means is that if you think that there's some ethical conflict or an ethical issue that you're facing in your public service, please, ahead of time, ask the city attorney's office or ask city staff what you should do to at least comply with the law. Because if you wait until the moment of the decision, or even after you've made the decision, to ask, you know, what should I have done, it's then too late, or there's not enough time to analyze it. So if in doubt, send it out. And also, on an introductory note, I failed to mention at the beginning, I'm presenting this presentation today on behalf of the city attorney's office, city attorney Chris Neumeier, and also your new assistant city attorney, Brian Wright Bushman. Some of you might have met Joe before. Joe's retired as city attorney, and city council has appointed me as city attorney now. I was the former assistant city attorney, and I'm available to work with you all in the community, and looking forward to working with this great city, and it's really nice to be here today. So on the next slide, AB 1234, ethical values and the laws that promote them. I talked about the four different areas that the Attorney General said that we should be talking about, and there's specific items in the law that these areas are going to be illustrated through. So on trustworthiness, that's bribery, conflicts of interest, contractual conflicts, campaign contributions. For respect, it's Political Reform Act disclosures, Brown Act, Public Records Act. Responsibility, it's gift restrictions, misuse of public funds, gifts of public funds, and mass mailing restrictions. And finally, on fairness, it's protection against bias, due process, incompatible offices, competitive bidding, and anti-nepotism. As I'd mentioned before, these are a lot of areas of the law to cover. By no means, by the end of this, are you supposed to be an expert on this. It's to familiarize yourself with these issues. So if there is a conflict or an issue down the road, you'll know perhaps I should look into this some more, talk to city staff or city attorney about it. So next slide, understanding ethics laws. Specifically, we're going to talk about what they cover, when you need to ask questions, and then resources for further reference. So I like this slide here. It illustrates, I think, the situation that you all now need to be conscious of, which is that you're public servants now. You've been appointed to commissions. And as President Abraham Lincoln said, nearly all men can stand adversity, but if you want to test a man's character, give him power. Well, you all do now have power and authority because you're sitting on commissions, and so you will face this test here that the President Lincoln was talking about. And the point of today is to make sure at least you know the legal standards and emphasize also the ethics that can go above and beyond that. So on next slide, it shows the four different areas of ethics laws that we will cover. We'll talk about personal financial gain, which I will cover, and that involves issues like bribery, conflicts, Political Reform Act, the Fair Political Practices Commission, or FPPC, gifts, contracts, and so forth. Assistant City Attorney Brian will cover personal advantages and perks, which involves gifts, city resources, tickets, number of other issues. And then I'll go back to me, and I'll cover government transparency, which involves Form 700s, Brown Act, and Political Reform Act. And then Brian will wrap it up with fair processes, which we'll be talking about due process and emphasizing the difference between acting in a legislative role and acting in a quasi-judicial role. And usually that distinction will only come up with city council or planning commission in most circumstances. Any questions at this point? All right. And also, as I mentioned, we will have a break halfway through, so that will be occurring in about 30 minutes, 45 minutes. Group one, personal financial gain issues. So basic principle, I don't think this is news to anyone. Public servants should not benefit financially from their positions. That's obvious, and I don't think anyone needs to be reminded of that. Some examples of it, bribery, financial interest disqualification requirements, which we'll go into in quite some detail during the presentation. Those issues are ones where you have a financial conflict of interest. And those are the ones that generally can trip up commissioners, council members, because if you have a financial conflict, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're aware that you might be biased. It's just the law says that you can't be involved in the decision. So, for example, if a business comes before you and you're making a decision affecting them and you've received $500 or more in income from them, you could have a financial conflict. And those are the different specific situations we'll talk about. And then revolving door restrictions, where basically you can't, as soon as you leave office, come back and be a lobbyist to the city for at least a year. So next slide, bribery. What is bribery? I think we all know what bribery is, but definition technically is conferring a benefit on a public official to influence a person's vote, opinion, action, or inaction. Penalties can be severe, loss of office, prison time, fines, restitution, attorney's fees, public embarrassment. And, of course, the person that's offered the bribe can also face all these penalties, too. An example of bribery being busted is Shrimpgate. Now, this occurred in the 1990s. It was a big deal in California at the time. The federal government had come in, and they did a sting, where they went to legislators in Sacramento and pretended that they were part of a shrimp company, and they were seeking from the legislature a law that would help their company, and they paid them money to pass it. It did actually pass, and it went to the governor. Governor knew about it, and he vetoed it, and then they busted the individuals involved. So an example of bribery on a big level in the capital of our state. Another example, Moreno Valley, 2014. A council member accepted an over $2 million bribe to rezone some property. It was going to increase the value of the property of about $5 million. Again, this was something where undercover FBI agents caught him doing this, and he had prison time for that, and real bad example of bribery. Similar crimes to bribery, extortion, that's getting something from someone wrongfully by using one's public position. For example, demanding that somebody pay you or else you won't make a decision that you know they're going to want. Receiving rewards for appointing someone to public office. And also embezzlement, which is just converting public funds or property to your own. So this brings me to the disqualifications based on financial interests. The general rule is that if you're making a decision or you're recommending something to council for a decision that they're going to make, if it affects your financial interests, not your personal beliefs, not necessarily your personal biases or relationships, but it affects your pocketbook, you might have to disqualify yourself from making that decision. Now, there's nothing wrong with having a disqualification. You're members of the community. Of course you're going to be involved in the community. But the law says we don't even want to tempt you with making a decision that influences your pocketbook. You just step back from making the decision. And so we're going to go into some examples of what that means. And specifically, the law says that you have a disqualifying financial interest if the decision you're making will have a reasonably foreseeable material financial effect distinguishable from the effect on the public generally, and that applies to you and your immediate family. So that's disqualification. We're going to go into some more detail on that because it isn't always intuitive. There's also situations where you might want to abstain from a decision just because you think you can't make an impartial decision, and that's up to you. You might feel so strongly about an issue that you think, I can't be fair about it. On the other hand, sometimes that's why we enter public service is, we feel strongly about issues and then you make decisions based upon that. But abstention is okay. where you just say, I'm not going to vote on this issue, I'm not going to weigh in on this issue because I'm biased for some reason, and you explain why. Next slide, what kind of interests? As I said, you have financial conflicts when your pocketbook's affected in a way where it's reasonably foreseeable, not that it's certain, but it's reasonably foreseeable, and there's a material effect. Well, what does that mean? First example, income. As I mentioned before, if you're making a decision on a business or an entity where they control $500 or more of your income, then you have a financial conflict. Next slide, the $2,000 rule. If you have an investment in a business entity or interest in a real property, that's $2,000 or more. Again, that affects your financial interests if they come to you for a decision. Next slide on real property. If you're making a decision affecting real property and your property is within 500 feet of it, you probably have a conflict. There's also a catch-all rule for even if it's more than 500 feet away, if a reasonably prudent person would believe the decision would affect the market value, then you might be disqualified as well. So an example of this would be if on planning commission, somebody came up to get a conditional use permit to allow their business to operate, say, later into the evening than they were allowed to date. And you have a business next door. And the last thing you want is to have, you know, more foot traffic late at night. You might be closed down early. You just don't want that traffic there. That decision on whether to allow those hours to be later could affect the real property value of your business or property next door because, well, if you decide to sell the property, maybe that you get a lower price because of all that extra foot traffic. It's just an example of where within 500 feet you might have a conflict. Another interest is gifts. The general rule is that if you receive gifts, and I don't mean holidays, birthdays, you know, amongst your friends. If you're starting to get gifts that you didn't get before normally, and they're coming from business interests that, you know, their only reason to be talking to you is because of your influence now because you're on a commission, that's when the gift rule kicks in. And you can receive up to $500 in basically unsolicited gifts. If it's over $50, you have to report it. And if it's over $500, it's illegal. But I'm not here to say that I'm ruining Christmas or birthdays or, you know, whatever holidays you might celebrate. It's that if somebody's given you a gift and basically you wouldn't have gotten it otherwise, then you need to be aware of this gift rule. So we went over a number of the different financial conflicts. $500 income. There's the $2,000 business interest investment. There's the 500-foot rule for real property or if it affects the market value of it. There's gifts that you're getting from somebody. And even if any of those apply, there's the public generally exception. Apologize for the – it's been a little wonky, the PowerPoint, but Brian's an expert at this. He'll fix it promptly. So even if you have a conflict, there's the public generally exception, which on slide 27 talks about how there is if there's an impact on the public generally, which means 25% or more of the public, then you can still make a decision even if that conflict exists. And this is to make sure that city business can occur. Because if, for example, you're voting on or you're considering or advising on the general plan for the entire city, well, obviously, assuming you do live in the city, you're going to be affected by the general plan. So you can't just have everyone conflicted out. So public generally exception can often mean that the conflict doesn't mean you have to step away from making the decision. And then how long? So basically, if you received income or you have an investment interest or it's going to affect your real property and it's at some point in time, 12 months before you make the decision, that's when it's triggered. You don't go back, you know, 10, 20 years and say, oh, I have that conflict. It's just 12 months back. So other ethics resources. I'd mentioned before that one of the big takeaways was, you know, if in doubt, send it out, meaning ask the city attorney's office if you have a question or city staff. A second major point is that if you do have a question and you don't want to go to city staff or city attorney for whatever reasons, you can call the Fair Political Practices Committee. They have a toll-free number, 866-FPPC, and you can anonymously ask them for some non-binding advice. If you're anonymous, they'll be clear. It's you know, non-binding. But they will kind of help walk you through some questions you might have. And so that's a great resource if you're wondering about something but you don't feel comfortable with approaching City Hall about it. You can also email them. The email is up there. There's a group, nonprofit group, called the ILG, Institute for Local Government. They have a lot of resources. And, of course, the city attorney's office is available to talk about any of these issues. So what to do if you're disqualified? If you do have a conflict and a decision comes before you and you realize you need to disqualify yourself from it, the rules are is you don't discuss or influence staff or your colleagues. You identify the nature of the conflict at the meeting, you leave the room, and you don't vote or discuss the matter. So, for example, when I talked before about somebody getting a conditional use permit to extend their business hours and you have a conflict with that decision, when that item comes up, if you're on Planning Commission, you would simply say before the item starts, I have the conflict, here's the conflict, and walk off the stage. And then just not be there for the discussion and decision. Then you come back when it's over. Yes?
So if you have a conflict, you just do it at the meeting. You don't have to tell you before the meeting, like a couple of days before, say this is on the agenda, and like have a conflict with it, or you just wait until the meeting?
There's no requirement to let me know ahead of time. But if you have any questions about whether a conflict exists, then certainly you can bring it up. But if it's just a slam dunk, you know there's a conflict, there's no need to do anything other than before the item starts, you just say, you know, I have a conflict, here's what it is, you know, I'm going to step away now. I'll be back when the next item comes up. Yes?
Can you speak as public comment, so recuse yourself from the decisions and from the panel, but come up during public comment and say, as a citizen, this is how I feel about this particular whatever it is.
Yes. Okay. If you have a direct interest in the decision, and you probably do, or else you wouldn't have a conflict. And it's called, you can come then back around to public comment and say, I am here to talk as a member of the public. You know, like for the example I gave of the extended business hours, you might then, you know, come back up and say, I'm a business owner in this neighborhood. I've talked to my neighbors. You know, they don't like the idea. And, you know, we hope you don't vote for this. Absolutely, you can do that. So on the next slide, and this actually goes to what you were just referring to, leave the room rule. You're prohibited from voting, discussing the matter if you have a conflict. You have to actually leave the stage, but there are limited exceptions. And if you own property or you have an owned or controlled business that's impacted by it, you aren't stripped of your First Amendment rights because you're a public servant. You basically just walk right on over and just get in line for public comment, and you can make your comments. So penalties. Penalties for violating these conflict rules. Interesting quote from George Washington, or one that I like here. Few men have the virtue to withstand the highest bidder. And so penalties, if that ends up applying, it can invalidate the decision, loss of office, and disqualification from future office holding. It can be a misdemeanor. It can be fined, monetary. You can pay the attorney's fees for yourself and the person that maybe brings the charges. And, of course, embarrassment, personal and political. So the next slide, I want to talk about special rules for contracts. If you're involved in making a contract on the city's end, and usually that's just city council, sometimes it's city manager. If you're involved on the city's end with making the contract, or you're involved in preparing a contract, the city just can't enter into it, period. End of story. That's Government Code 1090. And so the special rule for contracts is that for most financial disqualifications, you can just not participate in the decision and the business moves forward. But if, for example, the city is contemplating a business contract with a business you own, and you're making the decision, usually, like I said, at city council, you can't just walk away and then say, my colleagues will take care of it. You just can't enter into the contract. And that's the special contract rule I want you to be aware of. And the consequences of this is that if there's a violation, basically you get nothing and the city gets everything. The example of that is that if you, for example, sell real property to the city and you're on the council and you buy that property for the city, if you're found in violation of Government Code 1090, the city keeps the property and you got to give the money back. So pretty strict prohibition. Yes? Well, it would have to be a pretty acrimonious city council to have four of them go up against one or two. I don't know if it's ever been planned out beforehand, but it certainly could work that way. So an example of this is the Thomas versus Cal decision. So this is exactly what I was talking about. This councilman up in San Francisco, he owned some property, and it was surrounded by more property he didn't own, and the city wanted to buy this big area for a park. And the councilman knew that he couldn't sell his property to the city because he was on council. So what he did was he told a developer, hey, I'll sell it to you, and you sell it to the city. And then once it's before the city council, it's technically I'm not buying it for myself. Well, it was so brazen, even the escrow documents like pointed out this transaction where it was just a straw man. It went to court, and the court said, well, good news for the city. You get your money back. It was about $250,000, and you get to keep the land. And the council member, you get nothing. So that's an example of where 1090 can definitely cause some severe consequences. That's Government Code 1090. I do want to emphasize that unless you have the authority to make the contract or you're involved in the process leading up to it, this isn't going to be an issue. So it's usually city council that Government Code 1090 applies to. Most commissions, it doesn't come up that much at all, if ever. Yes?
So just out of curiosity, how could that have been done if you wanted to sell it? Because the city had to wait until he was not a councilman to sell it?
In that situation, I don't think that the property could be sold to the city.
Not as long as he was on the council or ever?
Well, once he's off the council, he could.
That's when.
Yeah.
So that's how it happened.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good question. And I've often wondered, like, how could they do that? I'm not sure how that could be done. I mean, the general rule is that they want to make sure that there's not even an opportunity for council members to benefit from, you know, entering into contracts with the council members' businesses or buy their, you know, stuff from the council member.
So basically, when you're not on the council, then you can
legally do that. Oh, sure. Yeah. Because you wouldn't be actually involved in making the contract on the city side. Yes. So that was the first part of the session, and now we'll go to group two, perks, and assistant city attorney. Oh, future employment issues. Whoa, hold on now. Want to go over that. Future employment issues. For 1 year after your service, you can't lobby the city. I don't know if that's really going to be a big issue here in Morro Bay. I don't think there's high-paid, high-heeled lobbyists coming up to the city that much. But there is a state law now. It's relatively new. That you have a one-year prohibition from just going right back out into the private sector and then being a lobbyist. And also, you shouldn't participate in decisions involving future employers. This is more of an issue for, like, San Diego or San Francisco and whatnot. But that is the law now. I want you to be aware of that. And so best practices, avoid temptation to look at public service as an opportunity for financial gain. I'm assuming that we're all on board with that, and you were before I even said this. And look at every decision, though, and ask yourself whether it involves some kind of financial advantage to you. And this is where folks get tripped up, because I don't think anyone has bad intentions here in the room, and no one's I don't think anyone here is planning to gain financially from their positions. I mean, the pay is very low. It's pretty much a volunteer job. You might as well consider it to be that. You know, you're being of service by being on the commission. Where people get messed up on this is when they inadvertently vote on something or inadvertently don't realize there was a conflict. And so that's the key point today, is just to allow you to have that gut feeling like, maybe I should talk to the attorney about this. Maybe I should, you know, flag this and ask the city clerk, like, is this something we should run up the flagpole? So just ask yourself, does it affect my pocketbook? If so, then you might have a conflict. So the next issue will be perks, and Brian will discuss that one.
Okay, so the first round was financial conflicts. To go back to kind of the point of this, the public expects that anyone that's holding public office is not going to be acting in their own best interest, but in the best interest of the city. So another way that you can act in your own best interest rather than the best interest of the city is to take a public position or use your public position, you know, kind of for the perks rather than for the service, so to speak. There are, and the key principle here is that public servants should not receive special benefits or perks by virtue of their position. One thing to know here, both, most of the laws we're going to talk about right now come from the Political Reform Act. The Political Reform Act is, let's just say it's very detailed, and it often changes. And there are exceptions to things, and there are nuances to things. So again, this is a good place just to think in broad strokes about gifts and about gifts rules. You're not expected to know every detail, and that's what we're here for. That's what the FPP is available for, the Institute for Local Government. But we'll go over the broader strokes. So there's two general kinds of perk rules, divided by the kind of perk it is. So there are the perks that other people give you, which would be gifts, and there are the perks that you give yourself, which, you know, or a self gift. When you take office or some kind of public position, you now have access to city money and you have access to city resources, and by giving yourself those illegally, you're also giving yourself a kind of perk. So starting with gifts, the perks that others give you, there are a couple bright line rules here. So the first is that you need to report gifts that you receive of over $50. And $50, you can get there. It's not just one gift. It's gifts over time for up to a year from a single person. So when you hit the $50 threshold, even if you got a couple gifts that were less than $50, when you hit the $50 threshold, you now have to report it on your Form 700. The other bright line rule is that gifts of over $500 a year are just illegal. You just can't accept them. And again, that's in the aggregate. So when you get to that $500 mark, that's when the limit hits. It's from a single person or entity in a single year. There are exceptions. Not every gift counts. I'll go into that in a minute. But so this is obviously for qualifying gifts. And then the other thing to just remind you about gifts, as Chris just talked about, receiving gifts may also give you a disqualifying interest. So not only do you need to be aware of, do I need to report this, and have I reached the limit, but also did receiving this gift or those gifts over the last 12 months create an interest for me that now requires me to disqualify myself from this decision that's before me. So to step back and just think, okay, well, what is a gift? This is a concept that you need to, this is a concept that you should have in your head. And you should have a general sense of whether or not you are receiving a gift. So a gift is any payment or benefit that confers a personal benefit for which the public official does not provide payment or services of an equal or greater value. So I'm going to unpack that. So, okay, first of all, it's any payment or benefit. So it's not just money. We're not just talking about someone giving you money. It's something, it's just a benefit, just anything of value. It can be a meal. It can be an item of clothing. It could be a car. It could be tickets to something. Anything that you would want. For which the public official does not provide payment or services of equal or greater value. So again, don't just think of money, and also don't just think of things that you get for free. So it's anything that you get for less than what it's actually worth. So if someone gives you something that's worth $100, but they give you a discount, so now you've received it for $80, you've still paid for it. You paid $80, and you might think, well, that's not a gift. I paid $80 for it. But in fact, you received it at a $20 discount, so you've now received a $20 gift under law. there are certain things. Oh, and then also, don't just think of it as things that, that you personally receive. It can also be things that others receive as a sort of as a means of giving you a gift. So if someone gives something to your spouse or to your child that is clearly meant for you, that the person would have no gift, no business giving that other person a gift, or maybe they get, you know, someone gives your wife some men's suits, or someone gives your husband some dresses or something like that that are clearly not meant for them, whatever it is, that will count as a gift to you. So not money, not just things you don't pay for, and doesn't even have to be given to you directly. There are some exceptions which are worth noting. This is not a full list, but this is some that may come up. So as Chris said, we're not trying to, the law is not trying to prevent your family and your friends from giving you gifts that you would have received before you were working with the city. Also, you are not prohibited from getting general discounts and things that are available to the public. So if there's a sale at some store and you get the item on sale just the same as anyone else would, that's not a gift. If you receive informational materials that are related to the kind of work that you do with the city, and you receive those materials for free, or you even receive free admission to some kind of educational seminar that's related to your work with the city or something like that, those are not gifts. Campaign contributions are not gifts. They do they are subject to lots of other rules related to campaign contributions, but they are not gifts. Free tickets to an event where you have some kind of ceremonial role. If you got invited to a Cal Poly baseball game to throw out the first pitch or something and you got a free ticket to the game, that's not a gift. And one of the more sort of humanizing aspects of all of this, there's a category called acts of neighborliness. So someone may just do something nice for you because they're your neighbor and they saw you on the side of the road and you needed help or whatever. And as long as the thing that this person does for you is the kind of thing that a neighbor might do for one for another neighbor who was in need, it's not a gift. There are other exceptions as well. So just speaking further about gift tickets, so tickets or passes can be gifts. There are times, I don't know how often this happens in the city, but there are times when you may, when someone may give a group of tickets, this might happen like more for the mayor or something like that, but there are times when someone may give the city free tickets to distribute to employees or to commissioners or something like that. Those generally would be subject to the gift limits. There are ways around that. I'll talk about a few of them. One of them is if you receive one of those and then you report it as income on your taxes, the city could have a gift policy. I understand it does not right now, but it may in the future, where it would divvy out those tickets in sort of a random order, so as to run interference between the person that gives them and the people that receive them. And there's also, this is also subject to general rules about what to do with gifts that you don't want. So you may think, what if someone gives me a gift and I didn't ask for it and I don't want it and it puts me over the limit? You're not out of luck. There's things you can do. So if you get a gift you don't want, or that puts you over the limit, you have a few options. And generally you should have, the number you should have in mind is 30 days. So you can take a number of steps within 30 days. So you can return an unused gift within 30 days. You can reimburse the donor for the fair market value within 30 days. And if you do that, I would advise you to put something in writing that says what you paid for it. You can donate the gift to a charitable or governmental organization and not claim a tax deduction. Or if it's something like a free pass or a ticket or something, you can just simply just not use it and don't let anyone else use it. So you're not stuck with what people give you. Gifts related to family fun. So gifts to your family, like I said, can be counted as gifts to you. And there also used to be a loophole where people could potentially give your child who was over 18, pay their tuition for college, and that would not count as a gift. That has been closed. So if somebody pays your child's tuition, even if they're over 18, that could still count as a gift to you. But that does not apply to scholarships that, you know, your child may receive from a college or something like that. There's also some special rules for raffles and gift exchanges. The general rule here is that if there's a raffle at the city, I don't know how often this happens or if it does happen, but if there is one and you receive the prize, the question is, was the gift given to the city by a third party other than the city, or was the gift provided to the city just through city funds or through a city employee? If the gift, or if the original gift that got raffled off came from a third party outside the city, then you need to report it if you receive the prize. But if it came from a city purchase or an employee that gave it to the city, then you don't need to report it. And in a situation like this, you would report, the reporting amount would be the fair market value of the prize versus minus whatever you paid to enter the raffle. There are some other perks that are worth mentioning specifically. One of them is free transportation, specifically from a transportation carrier. So we're talking about like trains, planes, automobiles. I had a professor in law school that said you could basically trace back all U.S. law to the railroads, and this is a case where that is probably true. So at one point, the railroads evidently loomed so large in California law that they could have, you know, they probably wanted a lot of political leeway. They were very powerful, and they could potentially garner favor by giving politicians free ticket to travel across America or something like that. So as a result, in the California Constitution, there is a ban on receiving tickets from transportation carriers. And this is worth taking note of because the penalty for receiving a ticket like that is actually forfeiture of office. So it's not just like a fine. You are just out of office. So if you ever receive or are offered free or discounted transportation by the carrier itself, a big red flag should go off in your head. If someone else has bought you a ticket, that's different. Other rules may apply, but we're specifically talking about if the carrier itself offers you free transportation. That does not apply, however, to frequent flyer miles you may get or any other general sale or discount on airfare or something like that that would be available to the public. The other thing to take note on is the prohibition of receiving honoraria for speaking or writing. So this is going to be if someone asks you to come and speak or appear in an event and then they pay you $100 for it or something like that, you can't receive that. The idea is that when you go and speak in your city capacity, it's just part of your job. It's you're already being compensated for it to the extent you're being compensated by the city, and you're not supposed to receive additional payment for that. There are some exceptions to this. If you give speeches and are paid for them as part of your business outside of the city and unconnected to the city, you're allowed to keep doing that. So the question to ask is, would I have been asked to come give this speech, and would I have been paid for it if I wasn't a public official? And if the answer is yes, then you can still accept the money. But if the answer is no, then you cannot. A couple cases in point here. The Stone and Youngberg scandal. We've got two case studies here. These are just to say, you may think that we're talking about fairly small dollar amounts. Like, so what happens if I just don't, like, okay, I got a gift at $60. I really need to put that on my Form 700. You might think it's not a big deal, but the FPPC, which is the agency in charge of enforcing these kinds of things, does crack down on that stuff, even to the extent of going after people who have not reported gifts between $50 and $100. So in 2014, there was an FPPC investigation that uncovered hundreds of public officials who had accepted meals and baseball tickets and brownies and other gifts from a bond finance company and didn't disclose them. There were 167 officials who accepted gifts valued between $50 and $100, and they all got warning letters advising them to adhere to the state laws. And there were 93 others who failed to report gifts and meals worth $100 or more. And they all received fines of $200 a year. The point is, I think the point to bear in mind here is first that the FPP does indeed care about these things, and they do go after people. And the other thing is that even though a warning letter or a $200 fine is not going to do that much harm in itself, a headline that cites your name and says violation of state ethics rules is going to do a lot of harm, even if it was just for, you know, going $10 over the limit. So it's worth avoiding and being meticulous in your reporting. A similar thing happened in 2013. There was another investigation that found, basically resulted in 97 officials being fined a total of $24,000 and receiving warning letters. And the thing I'll just point out is this one guy, a planning director for the school district, went to a Padres game and got a meal for $40 and then got a meal for $20 2 months later from the same people. And it put him $10 over the reporting limit, and he didn't report it. And they, I don't know if they fined him or gave him a letter, but the point is that they cared and they noticed, and he was only $10 over. Penalties for violating this for the Public Reform Act include fines up to $5,000 per violation. You may have to pay your own attorney's fees. You may have to pay the attorney's fees of the person that brings the suit against you. You could lose your office. You could be banned from holding future office, and you could even go to jail. Turning now to use of public resources, which are the perks that you give yourself. Personal use of public resources can include using city money, city staff times, the equipment, city supplies, using a city vehicle to run your own personal errands, using a city copy machine to print out your campaign flyers, whatever it is. There are some narrow exceptions to use of public resources for what are called incidental and minimal uses. So if you call, you know, if you make a personal phone call or you print out your flight itinerary, I think that's going to fall under a incidental or minimal use. But you shouldn't, I wouldn't recommend applying that liberally. Another area where you can basically get yourself the resources of the city unlawfully is through making inaccurate reimbursement requests. So if you're asking for, you know, being paid multiple times for the same thing, if you are not following the city's reimbursement policy, which there is the city does have a reimbursement policy, and if you're not aware of what are reimbursable expenses, the city can provide you with that information. This may, you know, this may not seem like an area where there's a lot of risk, but in fact, people up and down the state have run afoul of this. We'll talk about a few examples in a minute, but the consequences of this can be civil penalties. And if you're stealing money from the city, the fines are going to be some kind of a multiplication factor of that amount. So it's you will definitely lose money on the deal. You can also get prison time, disqualification from office. Then also what often happens to people is they don't want to report this income because they realize it's a legal income, but it's still income, and so they end up violating, you know, tax law, and so they get in all kinds of trouble. As a couple of examples here, we have a case study from the Sacramento Suburban Water District. This is the case that was reported on by the Sacramento Bee a few decades ago and led to the actual creation of this training because they realized people are really doing crazy things out there. Basically, I mean, you can imagine the scenarios, but people using agency credit cards for personal purposes and then misreporting the income, double dipping on expense reimbursements. Another example of how you might do this is if you work for multiple agencies or you're on multiple commissions and you get some kind of legitimate reimbursable expense, but then you charge it to both agencies. Someone was doing that, and they were paid $900,000 in 2 years in reimbursements because they were billing all of these things to different agencies that they worked for. So, not to give you any ideas, but don't do that. The next one is similar. Just racking up illegal purchases for hotels and for calls and other things like that. These are all obviously misuses of public funds. Finally, another way to use the perks of your office illegally is to use them for political uses. So public funds cannot be used to expressly advocate for or against a candidate or a ballot measure. You also can't use public resources to help your own campaign, and one way to do that is through mass mailings, which put your face and or your name before the public. The idea here is that just because you're an incumbent and you currently hold office doesn't mean you should be able to use city resources to basically help your reelection campaign. So the mass mailing rule is fairly complicated, but the basics are fairly simple. So what we're talking about here, a mass mailing is 200 or more tangible items. So we're talking about letters, we're not talking about emails, we're not talking about social media, that are sent out in the same month, and they feature the elected official, and they're paid for with public funds. So some letter is drawn up, it's got a big picture of whoever on it, or it's got the person's name in bold and all caps, or whatever it is, it's somehow featuring this particular person, and at least 200 of them are sent out in the same month, and they're sent out on the city's dime. That is a violation of the mass mailing rule. And finally, you can't make a gift of public funds. So if you ever find yourself in a position where you are approving the gift or the giving of public funds to something, but it seems to be just purely for a private benefit of somebody, that if a red flag should go off in your head. In other words, public funds are only supposed to go to private or to public purposes. And if they're not, then that is a violation of law and a violation of the California Constitution. So finally, best practices here. Avoid perks and the temptation to rationalize about them. And whenever you have doubts, definitely ask us, and ask early and ask often. And maybe just run through this checklist in your head whenever you receive something. So when you get something and you did not pay full price for it, just ask yourself, is this a gift? Am I allowed to receive this? Do I need to report this? And am I over the limit? And if you have questions about any of those things or you're not sure about them, then ask somebody and we will help you, or hopefully whoever you ask will be able to assist you. I think we're right at halftime, so why don't we take a break? What do you think, Chris? How long should we take? 5 minutes? Is 5 minutes good?
How long do you guys want to take a break for?
An hour.
I was going to say it has to be less than an hour.
Well, if you come back at 7:30 and sign your forms, we'll be out of here. Well, we should probably take a break. I think everyone wants to stretch their legs. So we'll take a 5-minute break.
And get ready, because when we come back, we're doing transparency laws.
All right. So we're going to now talk about group three, transparency laws. So transparency laws. This will be the third area we talk about, and this involves Form 700s, the Brown Act, and the Public Records Act mostly. And the idea is that the public has the right to see what's going on at City Hall and to know what's influencing decisions being made. So transparency rules. The two big ones are the Public Records Act and the Brown Act. And the Public Records Act allows the public to inspect basically any record held at City Hall unless there's an exemption or a privilege. And the Brown Act requires that there be open meetings as opposed to secret meetings when decisions are made. And two principles of the Brown Act is that you must conduct business in open and publicized meetings. Both the public has the right to be there and they have to know about the meeting. You can't just open the doors randomly at 5 o'clock and say, oh, we're having a meeting. The public has to know ahead of time. And that they have the right to be there. So, first part, public records. The general rule is that every record at City Hall is a public record and is disclosable upon request. That's the assumption that we start with. There are lots of privileges and exemptions. There's pending litigation exception. There's a lot of privacy exceptions. For example, you'll see that if you have a record requested from City Hall, they'll redact social security numbers, phone numbers, et cetera. There's also something called the deliberative process exemption, which is that the city should not have its internal decision-making processes as they're trying to come to a complicated and controversial decision subject to disclosure as it's going along so they can reach that decision. Afterwards, records often are public. But generally, the rule is everything in the city's possession is disclosable. And it's something to know because any document that comes across your desk or you might sign or might see, any email you send, the public can request that. And so City Hall will get requests, for example, of all emails that were sent or received by X commission, you know, for the first 6 months of 2017. I mean, that request might come in, and the city will need to produce those. If there's any issues with privacy or maybe some exemptions, then, of course, city attorney and city clerk and city hall will look at it and see if something needs to be redacted. Penalties for not disclosing records that are public records can be adverse media attention, costs, and fees. A financial interest disclosure, these are the Form 700s that you either have filled out or will need to fill out if you haven't within 1 year of assuming office. The basic principle behind what's called the Form 700, and in context, there's also a Form 802, a Form 803. There's about 50 different FPPC forms. The Form 700 is the one that's most commonly known because all public officials have to fill it out, and it lists your financial interests in the city. And it's disclosable to someone to look at. And the point is that if you're making a decision that affects your finances, the public should know ahead of time what your bias might be. You do it when you assume office, when you leave office, and you do it annually as well. Charitable fundraising. This rule applies to elected officials. And essentially, if you get someone to donate $5,000 or more to the city, then you have to fill out a Form 803, another one of those FPPC forms. And this only applies to elected officials, though. So best practices is assume all information is public or will become public in regards to the Public Records Act. And also in regards to the Brown Act, which we'll talk about, is don't be discussing agency business with fellow decision makers outside of a meeting. That's the general rule of the Brown Act, which is open meeting laws. But on the next slide, the basic rule of open meetings laws is that all meetings of the legislative body of a local agency shall be open and public, and all persons shall be permitted to attend any meeting of the legislative body of a local agency. Now, all commissions are considered to be extensions of legislative bodies, and so that's how the Brown Act applies to all commissions. So a basic rule of conducting business at open meetings, the majority may not consult outside a properly noticed meeting open to the public. The thinking behind this is that it's not just that the public's there when a vote occurs. It's that the public can see how the decision is made, what the discussion was, what sort of input went into how a final vote is cast. If you will, how the sausage is actually made. And so the actual deliberations, you know, it could be 5 minutes, it could be 3 hours, but the public gets to hear what's going on as you end up coming to your conclusion. Another key concept to there must be public meetings is that you can't have a serial meeting. So it's not just that a majority of your commission can't talk about business in secret or not at a public notice meeting. You can't have Commissioner 1 talk to Commissioner 2, they come to an agreement, and then Commissioner 2 says to Commissioner 3, hey, guess what, Commissioners 1 and 2, we just agreed on this, what do you say? And then Commissioner 3 talks to 4, and this all occurs over, say, a 5-week span. That's called a serial meeting or a slow motion meeting. You can't do that either. On that note, often on commissions and on the council, people will tell themselves, well, I am linked on an issue to one other person. And then you can talk to that other person to your heart's content because it's not a majority. And so often you'll hear people say, well, I'm linked to, you know, Commissioner X, therefore I can't talk to you anymore about this. Or you might think ahead of time, I have someone that I want to talk to about this issue. As long as it's a minority, it's not a quorum, you can do that. But once it's a quorum, a majority is having a discussion, you violated the Brown Act. There are, of course, exceptions. Generally speaking, as long as it's not agency business and a city-sponsored event, then you can go to it and a majority can be there. For example, if a majority of your commission goes to the County Board of Supervisors meeting, you can all be in the audience. It's not like you have to decide who can be there and who can't. You can all be at a party together. You can all be at a restaurant together. But you can't talk about city business that might come before you. And I want to caution you that just because you are at a party with the other commissioners or you're at a restaurant or you just happen to bump into each other, and all you talk about is the weather or the surf or, you know, sports, that doesn't mean the public's not going to think that you're doing some sort of secret meeting. So generally it's good to make sure that you don't It's better, even if you all end up in the same place, like, don't all just hang out, like, in one spot, you know, at the event together, because, you know, then the public might say, well, what were they talking about, you know? I think they were talking about decisions that they were going to make or are going to make. But exceptions, if another agency holds a public meeting, there's a conference, you can all go to that. You can go to social events together. Just be careful of the public perception. Next slide, what is a meeting? A meeting includes any gathering a majority of the members to hear, discuss, or deliberate upon any item that's within their subject matter jurisdiction. So basically, any decision that you might make, you can't, a majority of you, be talking about it until you're at the public meeting. You can talk about other stuff, though. And then I talked about, too, what is a meeting, means of communication. It's not just that a majority of you is in a room together talking about the business. You can also engage in a meeting through intermediaries, through email, through letters. That can't be done either. So what actually is a meeting when it happens? When a meeting occurs, it's when a majority or a quorum receives information on, discusses, or deliberates on any item on which they may legally act. It must be held within the boundaries of the city. It applies to both the council and the advisory bodies. Usually you need 72 hours notice, but you can call a special meeting, 24 hours notice. And as I'd emphasized, you can't have serial or slow motion meetings. What is not a meeting? The core rule is that if you don't receive information on, discuss, or deliberate on items that will come before you, it's not a meeting. And those situations can include individual contact. You don't have to avoid the other commissioners like around the city. Public conferences, other local agency meetings, community meetings, social gatherings. Any questions about the Brown Act? Okay, so agenda requirements. There must be a written agenda for each meeting. There has to be a brief description of the topics to be discussed. And this goes to the heart of the Brown Act, which is that the public has the right to see how city business is done. It's not enough to just say, we're going to hold a meeting. The public needs to know what you're talking about, because then they can decide whether they want to show up or not. So you need to have a brief agenda. Next slide, stay on point. This is an important issue because generally whatever is talked about at the meeting has to be on the agenda. Now, that doesn't mean you can't have maybe a few minutes of a discussion or not a discussion, but a few minutes of responding to public comment. You know, there can be a little bit of going off topic, but very briefly. Generally, any discussion you have or any sort of issue that you might make a decision on, it needs to be on the agenda because that gets to the heart of the matter. The public has the right to be there. You must allow a reasonable period of time for public comment before or during consideration of the item. And if you want to add a new item, there are emergency provisions to add a new item last minute, but it has to be a genuine emergency. It emerged after the agenda was printed, and there must be a two-thirds vote to consider that item. So it's very rare that that happens. On the next slide, agenda requirements, exceptions. As I'd mentioned, you generally can only talk about things on the agenda, so the public knows you're going to talk about it. But you can have brief responses, statements or questions, clarify. You can ask staff for some factual information. But generally, the best thing to do if a topic comes up that's not agendized is ask staff to put it on the next agenda. And so that's the request staff to report at a subsequent meeting, either on the topic or to agendize it. On the next slide, public participation in meetings. This, again, is one of the core principles of the Brown Act. The public has the right to be there, not only to know what you're going to talk about, to know in advance and to show up, but they have the right to participate in the meeting insofar as they can make public comments. Now, anyone can attend. It's not limited to just city residents. And this is an interesting point here that you can't require names, questionnaires, or conditions of attendance. If you've been watching city council meetings lately, the new mayor has been emphasizing that it's not required to fill out speaker slips. That never was a requirement in the city, but there's been an emphasis on now that you can come up and you don't have to give your name. For what it's worth, if you don't give your name, then it's a lot harder to clearly have your name in the record. I mean, the city clerk's not going to guess at your name. You just won't end up having your name in the record. The public also can record any of the meetings. Somebody can show up, and as long as they don't disrupt the meeting, they can take pictures, they can have a video camera, they can use their phone to record. The only time when someone has to leave, and this is very rare, is if they're disturbing the entire meeting, like the meeting just can't function. A good example is that if somebody were to show up at the meeting and they and their cohorts were to unfurl a big protest banner at the front of the meeting and literally people can't see the front, I mean, yeah, they would have to leave. If somebody holds up a sign and sitting in their chair and it's not disrupting the meeting, that generally would be okay. There's a lot of court cases about this, and in general, the public gets to show up, they get to have a few minutes to talk, and they get to then observe and listen to everything that occurs. Closed session.
Could I ask
sure.
Question? Thinking about the not requiring names, which I suppose is reasonable. Again, for me, if I'm willing to speak up, go ahead, put me on the record. But residents, and thinking of situations like medical marijuana or recreational marijuana is a big one where we've had those items on the agenda and you get crowds of people showing up who will speak passionately in favor or against and may not even live here. So you've got the council, say, making a decision about something or leading into their discussions about it, and you have 50 people who have just spoken passionately in favor of marijuana is the best thing, we all want this. And maybe three of them live in this town. So, on the one hand, it's a small town. We do know a lot of our residents. But on the other hand, we can't know everybody. So it sort of feels like it's fraudulent activity on the part of those public speakers. For me, if I want to be counted as a voice, I will say, this is my name. I live here. I work here. Just because to me, there's some weight
sure.
to that. So,
well, I think that the policymakers that are going to make the decision at the meeting certainly can and do take into account whether somebody has identified themselves as a resident or not, and that will impact whether they how much weight they give the comment. So if somebody comes up and says, this is my name, I live on, so-and-so street, I've been a resident here for so many years, that is probably going to get a lot more weight from the council than someone who shows up, refuses to say who they are, where they're from, and the council can make their own decision or their own judgment on whether it's, someone who doesn't have the interest of the city at heart or not. And, because public comment is not something that public comment needs to be heard. It's there's a right to say it, but that doesn't mean that the council or the commission, you know, is going to give it, you know, substantial weight. So I've been emphasizing how the public has the right to be at the meetings. You have to have the agendas. You get to talk at the meetings. There are times where the council and commissions can have closed sessions. Now, there's only limited times where they can have basically a private confidential session, closed session as they call it. And that's when there's real property negotiations, there's a lawsuit involved, labor negotiations, or personnel matters. And the way to understand when you can do these is generally if the city is in an adversarial relationship where they're negotiating something or there's a conflict, and revealing the position of the city would tip our hand, then you can have the closed session. And so it's very limited circumstances. The most common is for real property or litigation. There will be labor or personnel issues as well. When a closed session occurs, confidentiality applies, and there are penalties for disclosing what happens in closed session if someone were to do that. And when a final decision is reached, if one is reached at the closed session, then it must be reported out. Most closed sessions don't have anything reported because there's no final decision made. It's usually just to talk about litigation or maybe an ongoing real property discussion. So Brown Act penalties are failure to comply. The decision can be nullified. There can be criminal misdemeanors if there's intentional violations. There can also be injunction or mandamus or declaratory relief. Basically, the courts can reverse the actions and have the city do something else by court order. If somebody believes in the community there's a Brown Act violation, they have a responsibility to either within 30 or 90 days, depending on the type of the Brown Act allegation, to notify the city. And the city has an opportunity to what they call cure and correct, which is they have 30 days, the city does, to go back and redo everything. And if that doesn't occur, then the person can go to court and see if a judge agrees or not that there was a Brown Act violation. So that it was Section 3. And now Brian's going to go over fair process laws. And any questions at this point? Oh, yes?
I might have missed this. You said that they don't have to report out for a closed session unless that they have to report if an agreement is reached.
If a final decision is reached, which means that if there's, say, a real property negotiation, and the other party has already signed off on something, and then they agree to sign off on it.
But that doesn't pertain to personnel issues, right? Because they don't.
No, it generally doesn't. Yeah. I mean, it's rare to have something reported out of closed session.
So it's just on the real estate.
Yeah, or like for litigation, if the council authorizes a lawsuit to be brought on behalf of the city, that needs to be reported out, unless there's concern about the individual or party dodging service. So that's why generally most closed section actions aren't reported out immediately. I mean, if the decision is a big one, then you know, often the results will become apparent anyways. I know in Morro Bay the common practice is that if, say, there's a letter written to someone in response to a closed session item, that'll often be on the next agenda just so everyone knows, like, what happened. But generally, unless a final decision's made where all parties agree, and by all parties agreeing, that means that the council's looking at something that the other party's already signed off on. And that's rarely the case. Usually the council's being asked, you know, what are our directions for negotiation? You know, like, what is the range of, you know, where we should go with this real property purchase, or what should we do about litigation? It's ongoing right now. Here's an update on litigation and whatnot. Any other questions at this point? All right. Brian will take it away with fair process laws.
Okay. This is our last section before we wrap up. So the big principle here is that as a decision maker, the public expects you to be impartial and avoid favoritism. What we'll be talking about now may or may not apply to you depending on what board or commission you sit on. These will primarily be issues that pertain to city council members or planning commission members, but they're still important to know about even if you're not on one of those bodies. So the first thing that I want to just get you to think about is you may think, well, I hold this position and I do a number of different things, and no matter what, the same rules apply. And I guess I want you to think that, get the idea in your head that there's at least two different hats that you can wear, at least if you're on one of these boards, planning commission or the council, which are, on one hand, you can make basically legislative decisions, and the other hand, you can make, let's just call them, I mean, they're sometimes called quasi-adjudicative decisions, which is too long of a way to say it. Let's just say you're making judgments about particular cases. So if you're acting as a legislator or in your legislative capacity, you're establishing policies or you're establishing laws, or maybe you're making recommendations about policies or laws that will apply to the city as a whole, or at least to a large subgroup of the city, and it will apply equally to all of those people. And you're basically making policy that will govern a large group of people. On the other hand, if you're making judgments about things, or you're acting in your judicial or quasi-judicial capacity, you're making a specific decision about a specific application that's come before the board. So this is what happens when somebody applies for a conditional use permit or some kind of application for some kind of business they want to develop some tract housing or whatever else they want to do. Some examples of the legislative might be adopting an ordinance or a purchase of property or an award of a contract, and then on the judgment side, issuing a discretionary land permit or a business license. Or some other condition where there's a particular person or a particular business that's saying, okay, I know these are the laws generally, and I want you to specifically apply those to me. As you can yourselves imagine, if you put yourself in that person's shoes, you have a different expectation of how the body will act when they are passing a law versus making a specific judgment. We know that when our representatives make laws and pass policies, that they're acting from sometimes very strong policy positions. That's probably why they got elected, because they spoke out very strongly about specific things, and everyone knows that those are their issues, or these are the things that they stand for, and they might hold those things very strongly. And we're generally okay with that. We understand that the democratic process chooses those people, and even if we don't like their views, they were elected, and that's who they are. But then when you think about a situation where you've or someone else has specifically made an application to this body, and they want something done to their property or their business or something else, you expect that in that situation the decision makers might put aside these very strong views they have, and to the extent necessary to make an objective judgment about whether or not this person qualifies or doesn't qualify. And so in that case, we call that due process. You expect that when somebody is applying the law to a specific person, that that specific person is entitled to due process, which is a certain set of procedures and a certain objective approach to the decision where you're going to weigh all the evidence and you're going to make the determination based on the facts in front of you. So those are the two kind of different hats you can wear or a person can wear. And what we're talking about now is not the legislative capacity, but the judging or judicial capacity. So when you make determinations like that, you obviously want to be aware of your financial biases, but there's also certain non-financial biases that can come into play that still matter and could still cause someone to challenge a decision and could cause a court to overturn a decision. So the first would be just sort of a personal interest that is not necessarily a financial interest. So something, a decision, for example, that might affect your quality of life but might not affect you financially. So if some building is going to go up that maybe isn't within the 500-foot radius or something like that of where you live, but it's going to affect your view, or it's going to maybe create a bunch of traffic by where you live or a lot more noise or something, it might not affect your property value, but it still might affect your quality of life, and that's the kind of thing that might create a conflict. You also might just have some kind of personal animus against somebody. Maybe there's a history between you and a person, and that history has been very contentious, and it's public. Maybe it's appeared in the newspapers, or it's just something that everyone knows about, such that an objective third party would just say, there's no way this person can make an objective decision about this person's application. Like, you know, let's remember what happened last year, or whatever it was. And then finally, you can have a factual bias. So this occurs when a person on the decision-making body has special information that other people don't have. And to kind of get the sense of this, if you can imagine yourself in the position of the applicant, when you come to a meeting of the people who are going to make the decision, you expect that they're going to make that everything that is the basis of their decision will be discussed that night. And you, as the applicant, will have a chance to respond to all of that information. So if there is any evidence that it goes against you, you can respond to it and you can counter it. But if it turns out later that you, even despite your best efforts, you respond to all of the arguments that are brought up, and then you somehow find out that council member whoever or commissioner whoever actually made the decision based on X, Y, and Z, but only A, B, and C were talked about at the meeting, that would just be fundamentally unfair because you never had an opportunity to respond to X, Y, and Z. So these are different kinds of ways that the process can be unfair. The next slide, due process equals fair process. We just have a couple cases here. I'll just read the quote that's on here. A councilman has a right to state his views on matters of community policy, and his vote may not be impeached because he does so. So I just want to kind of draw a line here, and it's admittedly not a clear line. It's more of a principle, which is, in cases of fairness, you should ask yourself internally whether you really believe you can make a fair decision about something, given your financial, we're setting aside the financial now because we've discussed that, but even just given your how the decision may affect you personally or any personal bias or animus you might have. Sorry, I lost my train of thought. You should ask yourself personally whether you have the ability to make an objective decision. But you should also ask yourself whether the public will perceive you as having that ability. Because even if you know sort of in your heart of hearts that you actually can act fairly on this, if you have a long and public history of roundly criticizing this person, or if you said even before the item came before you, there's no way in a million years I would ever vote yes on this, then the public is going to have the perception, and a judge may well have the perception, that you just could not make an objective decision about this, and therefore the process wasn't fair, and therefore the vote should be redone. So think not only about whether you are actually capable of acting objectively, but also whether the public will perceive you as being capable of acting objectively. And even if you have strong views about things, it's best not to express those, at least with any particularity, before the decision is made. And the example I was using in our last session, if any of you have ever, even if you don't know much about the process of electing a Supreme Court justice, what you may know is that people who are potentially going to be appointed to be on the Supreme Court will never answer how they would rule on a particular question, right? So like, how would you rule if the abortion came before you, or something like that would be a big one, or you know, whatever. Whatever it is, they will never say exactly how they would rule if this case came before you, because if they do so, they will create a sense that they are not capable of acting, of considering the question objectively, because they've already made up their mind on it. That's kind of what we're talking about here. And finally, if it is perceived that you have this kind of conflict, then the courts, if someone challenges it, the court could decide that there's just no way that you were able to act unbiasedly, and they will basically void the decision and require a revote without that person taking part in the decision. On the next slide, fair process laws, incompatible office prohibitions. This is another kind of basically conflict a person can have that's not necessarily related to their finances. And this is if you hold incompatible offices. So, you know, not everyone, but there are people who hold positions on multiple boards or multiple commissions, whether they be in the city or in different kinds of districts. And sometimes that can be fine, but sometimes it's not. And you can imagine why as we go through these. So offices can be incompatible if there's either a clash of duties or loyalties. So you have one constituency over here that, I don't know, really wants X, and one constituency over here that really doesn't want X. And most of the time you probably won't be talking about X, but that one time that X comes up and you have to make a decision on it, you're going to be torn. Like, do I vote in favor of this constituency who I'm supposed to represent, or this one who I'm also supposed to represent? So if there's a possibility of that happening, then your offices are incompatible. Another way that your offices can be incompatible is if one office is overseeing the other office. So the classic example here is you can't be both on the City Council and the Planning Commission, because Planning Commission decisions are appealed to the City Council. So you shouldn't have the opportunity to overturn yourself, essentially. A possibility of these sort of duties clashing would be maybe if you were on both a City Council and a district, you know, like a water board for a water district or something like that. And like I said, with the supervising ones, with the City Council, being on the City Council and the Planning Commission. And what will happen if you accept a public commission, you're sworn in or whatever it is to formally accept, at the time that you formally accept that position or you're sworn into it, then you are automatically off of the board that you were previously on. The next topic is competitive bidding requirements. So this, again, goes to not necessarily your own financial interests, although your financial interests could be involved in the city's purchasing, but just basically looking out for the public purse, making decisions that are in the financial interests of the city. There are lots of examples of purchases that cities make where the city has pretty broad discretion on how to make them. So the one where the city has the most discretion is when you're hiring people to perform quote-unquote professional services, so like accountants, for example. You don't need to pick the cheapest accountant. And like that hopefully, I mean, I think that's somewhat intuitive. When you're hiring someone who requires the professional skills of an accountant or a designer or an architect, their quality as a professional is very important, and not just the price of their services. So a city can consider other things besides just price, or at least it has the discretion to craft its purchasing policies however it wants to on those issues. It may well decide that it's going to pick it based on the lowest bidder, but it doesn't have to. Basically, you need to look at the city's purchasing ordinance to determine how that's supposed to go. On the opposite side of that is purchasing for public projects and public works. So this is, think of, you know, quintessentially, if someone's building a building on city property, or if they are redoing the streets or putting in new sewer pipes or whatever it is, those would be public works types of projects. And the sense is, at least what state law kind of assumes, is that there are lots of contractors out there who are all available to basically perform the same services at essentially the same level of qualification, presuming they all have the appropriate licenses. So in those cases, you are required to take the lowest, it's called responsible bidder. As long as the person has said they can do the work and they have the credentials to back that up, you need to pick whoever gives you the lowest bid. And there's also a formal process for seeking bids and making sure that gets distributed widely so people from across the state can bid on those projects. If you don't award in accordance with state law, then the contracts can be basically voided, and the city may have to pay the costs of whatever costs the other bidder who didn't get the award but should have, whatever cost they paid to put together their bid. These kinds of issues cause more hassles than you may think if you're not involved in this. For some other cities I work with, there's often issues, especially on big projects, with people protesting, and you can't award to this person, you have to award to this person, and people get really nitpicky, and it can create issues that probably take more time than it should. But but it happens a lot. Yes.
Is there a threshold for competitive bidding?
Yes, anything over $5,000. Yeah. So let me caveat to that. There's sort of two regimes. So the basic is anything over $5,000. There's also a different purchasing system that's allowed under state law called the Uniform Public Construction Cost Accounting Act. And I do not know off the top of my head whether or not Morro Bay has adopted that. Have they? I didn't mean you. I meant Dana. So in that case, the thresholds are different. And I believe it's something like up to $45,000. You don't have to, you can do it very informally between $45,000 and about $175,000. You can do it informally, and above $175,000, you have to do it formally.
As Brian had mentioned, so keep in mind there's for competitive bidding, there's really three categories. Public works, which is regulated by the state, and there's just not much discretion unless you adopt, as Brian was saying, the system that allows higher thresholds. But then for city contracts in general, there's supplies and equipment, which the city has to have a purchasing ordinance, which basically requires you to essentially take the lowest price. And then there's professional services. So you have public works, supplies and equipment, and then professional services. And they're all under different systems.
One other thing to know, just as we were talking about public contracting, the general way that public contracting goes is you hire a designer to design your work, to design the project, and then that design, you base the solicitation for a contractor off of that design, and then you hire a contractor. There is another way to do it called design bid, where the same person does both the design and the construction. That is allowed in some cases, but there are strict limitations on that under state law. So I don't need to go into that here, but just know if you ever are in a context where you're involved in a decision to approve a design build contract, just know there are special limitations on when you can do that.
By the way, Brian's an expert in public works, as you can tell. He loves to talk about all the different requirements.
Sorry, I'm waxing poetical on this. On the next topic, fair process laws contained a few other things. Just a reminder that I guess another conflict you could have is if a decision would affect your family, not just you, but would affect your family, and not just financially, but in some other way as well. So again, it's never just you; it's also your family. The second bullet point: campaign contribution restrictions. This is a rather obscure rule. But generally speaking, campaign contributions don't receiving a campaign contribution doesn't restrict you from voting on an item when the person who made the campaign contribution comes before you. Because for various reasons. But there is a rather specific rule. If you sort of follow the steps here. So if you're on the Planning Commission, but you're running for City Council, and someone contributes to your city council campaign, and then that contributor comes before you for a decision before the Planning Commission, then you have to disqualify yourself from that decision. But if you then get elected to the city council, and the person that contributed to your city council campaign comes before you at the city council level, you don't have to disqualify yourself. So. I don't know what the logic is of that, if there is any. But
the courts have clearly ruled that you cannot restrict someone's ability to be involved in political activity, which includes donating money for elected office. When it comes to appointed office, there can be rules, and so there's over 100 years of case law saying that if the government, whether it's the state of California or Massachusetts or the federal government, were to say, if you donate money or you donate your time or you donate resources to a political campaign, you then basically can't do business in that city because that decision might come before the elected body, that just severely restricts citizen rights. And so there's a whole body of case law on that. When it comes to appointed positions, the state has just kind of filled that vacuum because there really isn't much of case law there. So they have the rule that Brian was talking about.
And then finally, it's illegal to solicit campaign contributions from employees, sort of if you're specifically targeting them. If you solicit campaign contributions from the public generally or from a group of the public that happens to include public employees, then that's not a problem. But you don't want to create essentially an unfair power dynamic where someone may feel that, you know, keeping their job is dependent on giving the council member a campaign contribution or something like that. Finally, best practices. So just, again, I guess picture yourself as that person who is coming before the commission and asking for something that matters to you, and then think, how would you want those people to act? And essentially that should hopefully guide you. Or think of from a judge's perspective, if they got out all the facts, would they think that this process was fundamentally fair? So the decision should be fair. It should be based on the merits, not on a bias or some kind of information that only one person knew about. You should keep politics separate from your relationship with city employees. And you should avoid committing to or commenting on certain decisions before you're required to make them. And I will let Chris take us home.
Okay, well, we're almost there. Thank you all for being here today. Just to do a quick wrap-up, we talked about four different areas of public ethics, AB 1234, required training. We went over personal financial gain, which involves bribery, conflicts, the Political Reform Act, Fair Political Practices Commission, gifts, contracts, and penalties. And the takeaway point from that was that there are financial conflicts that the law recognizes that you may have when you're making a decision, which might not jump out at you intuitively as affecting your decision. But if you think that it could possibly affect your pocketbook, even though you don't think it's going to bias you, you definitely want to consider talking to the city attorney's office, talking to City Hall, because you don't want somebody down the road to say, oh, well, you made a decision in violation of conflict laws. And so we went over some of those, which was the $500 source of income. We talked about the 500-foot rule for real property decisions. Talked about $2,000 if you have that in a business. And I'm assuming that everyone in this room is not going to let money like that influence their decision, but you need to know that that is the law. And the simple solution, which can be easily done, is you just walk away from the dais when the decision comes to you. You disqualify yourself from it. And that's why you want to have that gut feeling. If it affects your pocketbook, ask about it ahead of time. And there's no problem with having those conflicts. You just can't be part of the decision. We talked about personal advantages and perks. That involves gifts, city resources, tickets. The big issue there is gifts. As Brian talked about, it can be pretty convoluted. It's not just somebody, as Brian said, giving you something with a bow on it. You might get discounts. You might have something that you wouldn't ordinarily receive, but now that you're a commissioner, like some local business is offering you some advantage or perk. Generally speaking, if it's over $50, you're going to have to report it. If it's over $500, you just can't take it. But this doesn't mean that the gift exchanges, if you will, that normally were occurring in your life beforehand with relatives and friends for birthdays, holidays, and all that, you can keep doing that. The general rule is if you're starting to get gifts from people that wouldn't have given them to you otherwise, that's going to be something that has strict limits on it. It's going to need to be reported, and there's going to be a spotlight on it. We talked about government transparency, Form 700s, which everyone needs to fill out, financial interest in the city, and then the two big transparency rules of Brown Act and the Public Records Act. So Brown Act, again, is just basically open meeting law, which is that when meetings are held to make government decisions, the public gets to know ahead of time you're having the meeting, they get to be there, and they get to know what you're talking about, and they get to say something during the meeting. And so that's what the Brown Act basically is. And when people say, oh, there was a Brown Act violation, they're claiming one of those rules or one of the details of those rules wasn't followed. And then Public Records Act, just remember every email you send that involves city business, every document that you either generate or you're reviewing, generally speaking, the assumption is that it's a public record. So somebody can make a request to the city and say, I want that document. There are a lot of exceptions and privileges, but we always assume the starting point is the public can get the document if it's at City Hall. And then we talked about fair processes. Brian went over that, and basically it's to ensure that decisions are fair, and that involves having due process. There's different rules on whether you're acting for policy or whether you're acting basically as a judge, quasi-judicial. And the essential idea is that you want everyone to get a fair shake. You want to be impartial. Don't be biased. And the biases that can disqualify you, this goes back to the idea of financial conflicts. The biggest biases you can have are a financial interest in the decision. You also, if you have broadcast publicly before you're making a quasi-judicial decision what you're going to do, then that can be a bias. And the best way of looking at that is we all know in our gut intuitively that if a judge in a criminal case were to say before the trial, I'm going to convict that guy. I don't care what they say up there. You know, we know that'd be wrong. And so that would be the same thing here. But for a congressperson or a council member or a commissioner to say ahead of time, you know, I'm either for or against this big project, or I'm for or against, you know, this policy, well, that's why people get involved in local government. That's okay. So you got to look at the differences between policy and acting as quasi-judicial. So those were the four things that we talked about. And if you want to read more about all this, show of hands, who wants to get more documents? Yeah, you don't have to sign now. We'll be here. Institute for Local Government does a lot of publications, and we can provide those to you. And then the questions to ask. I'd mentioned a few takeaway points. One was, if in doubt, send it out, which means ask City Hall, ask City Attorney if you have any questions. Another takeaway point, if just in general you're wondering, is this an unethical or illegal thing that might be happening? And I don't think that anyone's going to intentionally be violating the law. But sometimes, because there are so many laws, you might find yourself in a situation where, you know, you're not sure. Well, ask yourself, is this decision that I'm about to make, are the details behind this decision something I am 100% comfortable with being a headline in the local newspaper? Am I going to be totally fine with the public seeing what went into this decision and the decision I made? If you are a little uncomfortable with it being on the front page of the paper, then there might be an issue. And then in that case, there's two issues. One, is it going to violate the law? And two, is it something that personally, for your own ethics, your own moral compass, you think that it's something that you shouldn't be engaged in? And also, how do you want to be remembered? None of you in this room are doing this for the money. I mean, like I mentioned before, it's a pittance that public servants get paid, especially commissioners and council members. So how do you want to be remembered? I mean, you have some volunteer ethic. You have some public service ethic while you're doing this in the first place. When it's all done, do you want to be remembered as a good public servant or somebody that had a cloud over their name? I'm sure you all want to be remembered as good public servants, and so that's a question to ask yourself. So the key lessons. The law sets minimum standards for ethical behavior. The violations of the laws can carry stiff penalties. When in doubt, ask and ask early. And then it's your choice from here on out on how high you want to set your standards. We've gone over some of the baselines. We're always here to help. Feel free to contact us or the FPPC if you have any questions. And congratulations. You're done with your 2 hours of training. Please sign your certificates and provide them to the city clerk. And have a good evening. Thank you.